Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Yeah, just waiting for our newest reporter to call in here, so I'm going to put a little note here on his Facebook page. Call in, please. There we go. That's Dave Schneier. With Schneier at 6. Well, it's 6, so we're going to hopefully, in fact, he might already be there. I'm just blocking it out with my Facebook. Nope, he's not there yet. Okay. Anyway, so lots going on. This is a very last-minute show because I had so much going on. I've been listening to the Supreme Court oral arguments from yesterday. They're absolutely fascinating. The arrogance of the leftists, the absolute unbridled hubris, especially concerning Justice Sotomayor, who has no business at all being on the Supreme Court with her kind of attitude that we are the dictators, we are the supreme authority over the Constitution. The Constitution's nice, but, you know, we decided in Marbury versus Madison that we're in charge. And we did it by logic. We used our own logic, so we appointed ourselves in charge, and therefore it's okay. And this is subtle law. In fact, even Amy Coney Barrett said the exact same thing, that, well, this is subtle law. The Supreme Court is the ultimate authority on the Constitution. And this ridiculous nonsense came out that that they are, how do they put it? I had this, in fact, I was going to post it, but I didn't get the good graphic with it, so I took it down. But I did a recording from the greatest moments of the Kavanaugh hearing when Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham, in a rare moment of clarity and constitutional authority, challenged frat boy, what's his name, Kavanaugh, about Roe v. Wade. And what is it, you guys? Do you think you just make up rights as you go along? Like, yeah, we can with the Supreme Court. And this ridiculous notion that only a constitutional amendment could overturn the decision of a Supreme Court was absolutely insane. Anyway, we'll get into more of that as the day goes on. We've got Jonathan Mosley, our legal reporter, will be on in a little bit. I've got our new reporter here. Starting. We have two new reporters. Cindy Cagle will be on at 6:30. She's done a few reports already. But let's get to Dave Schneier with Schneier at 6. And he was on last week and had been on for a while. So it's really good to have him back. And I thought, this is so good. We got to get a regular report from Dave. So, Dave, good morning. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm having a great time, working hard, doing my Supreme Court thing and criticizing the idiots on the panel. You know, so I've got kind of like a secret dream. Well, it's not so secret because I'm on the radio broadcasting it. But the Supreme Court, yeah, hasn't had a non-lawyer on the court for over 100 years. And I want to be the first. You know, in fact, I think just going through the confirmation hearing, you know, with my opinions and saying the things that I want to say about their idiocy, about their judicial tyranny, about the fact that they had no power to rule in Marbury versus Madison, that they are the ultimate authority, that actually Congress can overrule them any time and recall their sorry asses for bad behavior. Just little things like that, I think. I kind of like to drop on the national debate and see how it goes. But let's see what's of interest to you. And, of course, we got Gene on the line, too, Gene, our producer. But, yeah. So,
yeah,
good morning, sir.
I would like
go
to
ahead.
Talk about, yeah, good morning. I would like to talk about something else. But before that, I'll add to what you know, you're talking about. So my parents are friends with with a guy named David Vail. And
yeah, careful mentioning names until we know. Unless it's really relevant to the thing, yeah, that's okay. Unless they're public figures.
Right, so,
public figures, I don't care.
So,
yeah, anyway, go ahead.
He got into this, but okay, so named David. And he is an abolitionist for, you know, against abortion. You know, he says basically is the states should have the right to nullify, you know, a ruling like that because of kind of like the same thing with jury nullification. It's an unjust ruling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the same way he thinks the states should have the right. And it's a really interesting idea. Like, I have a lot of literature about it and things like that.
No, it's a good topic.
And so, yeah.
And it's called the 10th Amendment is what you're really talking about. So the states don't have to nullify. They don't need to come up with a new procedure. They don't need to, you know, sort of make new law here because the law already exists. And, in fact, one of my arguments against Roe v. Wade is right out of the 10th Amendment that those powers not specifically reserved to the federal government nor delegated to them are reserved to the states and the people. And first the states and then the people, you know, sort of like there's a logical sequence to that. In other words, the people can create the law, and that's what we do here at Action Radio. So there's I'll send you my video on the seven most important minutes of the Kavanaugh hearings. I think you'll find it really interesting. Like I said, they couldn't pull up the graphic. Well, the graphic, nobody looks at my post, so I don't even bother with that. Anyway, that's the amendment right there, the 10th Amendment. And I would argue that Roe v. Wade, in fact, the title of the show today, Roe v. Wade was never a legal decision nor legal national policy. And the reason is because the federal government has no jurisdiction over health. The only legitimate the only legitimate jurisdiction like the CDC has is over the borders to prevent people coming into the country, you know, with a dangerous communicable disease. And that they actually do have that authority because the federal government has authority over the borders. But the CDC has no authority whatsoever inside the country. And yet, look what's happening. You know, they're looked on as, you know, the Center for Direct Control. They're now tracking people in airports and doing other things. But there's your first argument against Roe v. Wade is that the government has no jurisdiction over health. That's a state matter.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. This is fun.
Yeah, no, I would argue that, obviously, you know, I support the state's rights. I would argue there should be a federal issue just in the opposite direction of what it is, just for an issue like that. Because I don't really consider it to be a health issue. I more consider it to be a, you know, genocide issue.
Okay.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that's kind of the perspective I take. I mean, like, if we believe that it's actually, like, for instance, should we allow the states to legalize homicide? You know, I would say obviously not.
Mm-hmm.
So.
No, you make a really
right
good
now
point.
It's a state issue. Just because, you know, it's because no states have legalized it, so that's why it's a state issue for homicide, for instance, you know. But
well, they've legalized, I think some states have assisted suicide. For example. Mm. So that's something, I think Oregon's big on that. I remember when Dr. Kevorkian was sort of making the rounds trying to tell people about the virtues of killing themselves. And so that was kind of an interesting time in our history. But as far as there is a federal interest in the 14th Amendment of equal protection of the laws, and that's, you know, if the equal protection, I mean, the Supreme Court, the leftists are arguing that you can protect the life of the mother or not put any undue burden on the mother, but they're not arguing at all for the equal protection of the baby or the preborn, you know, or the father, you know, over his life choices too. So there's a huge inequity in this abortion decision, and it can't be because women give birth and men don't. So there's an obvious biological inequity, but as far as rights go, you know, rights are supposed to be equal, and so they may be different, you know, slightly between the sexes simply because of the biological difference. But even so, the rights of a baby to life are every bit as strong as the rights of a mother. You know, even stronger than the right of mother to not be burdened. And it's an interesting question. I'm going to get to Gene's take on this too. But anyway, talk about what you want to talk about. We're going to be spending a lot of time on this other issue today.
So I was watching a video. This is actually, you know, a public figure. His name is John Doyle. And the video was about the link between leftism and Satanism. And it wasn't really like, you know, and it's not like, you know, George Soros, you know, Fauci being the Antichrist, like the philosophical link, you know, between like leftism and like, you know, what Satan would do. And it was premised off a radio broadcast. I believe the guy's name is Paul Harvey. And it was called, you know, if I Were the Devil. And he's just listing off all the stuff that he would do. And then so much of it is like stuff that the left is already doing, you know, like promoting, you know, pornography, promoting drug addiction, you know, encouraging, you know, lawlessness in the streets, you know, it was recorded during like the 60s. And then now, you know, like the left is actually promoting all this stuff. So it was a really interesting video.
Yeah. Paul Harvey is one of the greatest figures in radio history in our country ever. And Paul Harvey used to talk like this. And now the rest of the story. Good day. That was Paul Harvey. Paul Harvey, if you ever listen to him, you know, as one of my favorite talk show hosts until he became a total leftist, Ron Owens in San Francisco, this is back like 20, 30 years ago, was talking about Paul Harvey as one of the most compelling voices in radio. He had more stations than Rush Limbaugh by a factor of three, but his broadcasts were shorter. He was his like Rush. He was his own operation, and he did a very conservative take on the news, and it was Paul Harvey news and commentary. So he didn't make this pretense that he was a journalist, because he always said news and commentary, and so that you knew there was a conservative take on the news. He used to talk about Head Red Gorbachev. you know, head red as opposed, you know, as communist, you know, and he was very absolutely pro-American. He was big. He was really huge during the Reagan administration. And so Paul Harvey, one of my favorites, even when I disagree with him, but he used to do, and this is something you might find fascinating too. He used to do something called the rest of the story. And he would take famous people, but he wouldn't tell you who they were. And he'd give you their childhood, and he'd go through all these different scenarios of their life. And, you know, I remember one in particular was this this woman who as a baby was sick and as a child was horribly sick, and nobody thought she would live, and no one thought she could do anything. They all thought she was stupid and all this other. There's all these horrible things happened to her all through most of her life. And then she grew up to be Lucille Ball, you know, of I Love Lucy. And so it was like, whoa, I didn't know that. So all these things you find out about people, about the struggles along the way, and you realize that, you know, most great people have had a struggle. And so Paul Harvey, if you want to look into radio and just a really great personality, Paul Harvey is a good person to look into for life stories. Yeah. Anyway, back to so what was he saying though about the devil and or Satan and leftism? Because I think you're onto something.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, it's just like this whole entire, I guess, what it boils down to is like this me ideology. You know, like everything revolves around, you know, the me, and that really is, you know this extreme. You know, selfishness, you know, this like I have all these positive rights no matter what the detriment is, you know, to society. I can be as degenerate as I want, you know, no matter what to the detriment of society. And, you know, it is satanic, those things. I mean, it is, you know. And then also another point he brought up is that people are using, I guess this isn't as, but whatever. In Texas, people are actually using the fact that abortion is listed as like a satanic ritual, like by like the church, by like the Temple of Satan or whatever. They have abortion as like one of their like sacraments. And so people are actually using that as an excuse to actually receive abortions in Texas legally.
Oh, I see what they're saying. It's just practicing their religion. Is that what they're saying? It's a free expression of religion. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. Well, that let's talk about that for a minute, because you raise a very interesting topic. In other words, the limits of any right are where that right takes away somebody else's right. Okay, so you have the Second Amendment is an absolute right to own and carry firearms, but you have no right to use them in a way that would be against the law. For example, to hurt somebody else with a firearm. Or threaten somebody else, or brandish in front of somebody else. So the right, ends at own and carry, and the use of it becomes regular law because other people's rights and personal safety are involved. And so that's where it ends. Same thing with abortion. You know, if you're going to say that abortion is a religious right, okay, well, then you've still got the right of the baby. You've still got the right of the life that has its own right, and that's every bit that's as strong as anybody else's life. And this is where the abortion decision falls short, on two ways. One, the First Amendment in the freedom of religion, because all rights are practiced individually, and as long as your right is practiced individually, that's fine. But if in practicing your right you're going to hurt something else, a person, an animal, animal sacrifice or something like that, okay, now you're going to be on your right because you're not exercising it individually. Right. And so this is how you can, in a way, explain to other people how a right works. Well, it's just freedom of religion, man. I don't want to sacrifice chickens for my voodoo. OK, no, I don't think so. use an effigy. OK, do something that's and if you want to do that, okay, that's fine. And of course, if you want to, butcher a chicken for dinner, that's okay, too. But the idea that you're, sacrificing and tossing it away, I got problems with that. But especially as far as abortion goes, to say that abortion is a religious right because you worship Satan. Okay, you can worship Satan. I mean, I'm not saying I'm not going to stop that free exercise as long as people are doing it individually. So you see the line I'm drawing here. That if you're going to extend that to aborting a baby and ending the life of the baby, then you're going beyond your individual right because you're not talking about your right. You're talking about somebody else's right, to even live. And that's where I would make the distinction. Does that make sense?
But, I didn't finish the video, but basically, and it was interesting. You brought up, also just with, again, like what the left is like promoting, on every single social front, like it's literally, it's literally like the same stuff that guy was saying what he would do. It was just really, it's almost like a prophetic speech that he gave, because he gave it in the 60s. The left wasn't as, that far yet. But then now it is like, it was really.
No, but they knew what the left was going to do. And so that's an interesting thing that a lot of folks like Paul Harvey and I think some of the other people who were warning about the naked communist. I think Leon Skousen, I think, wrote this book. You know, and there's various books that were warning exactly what was going to happen. You know, and Paul Harvey's, you know, If I Were the Devil. I don't think he wrote that, and I think somebody else did.
No,
but, you know, if you really want to screw up America, this is how you do it. But see, the communists have been here in this country since the 30s. You know, you look back at the Depression. Yeah. I mean, the communists saw the Depression as the perfect example of the failure of capitalism, of let's, you know, workers of the world unite, which, of course, is BS, because what it really means is the elite unite and suppress, you know, the entire population by getting rid of the middle class, much like what's happening now. They call it class warfare. And say, you know, workers of the world, you'll be in paradise if you just let us, you know, control you and get rid of the middle class, you know, the aristocracy, the bourgeoisie, I think they call it. Yes, the bourgeoisie. Right?
Yeah.
So you get rid of the middle class, and then everything will be great, right? Well, it's not. You know, the middle class is what makes America what it is, of the most people having the greatest distribution of income over the largest number of people, as opposed to a very rich, wealthy elite, you know, with 90, you know, the top 1% with 99% of the money and the bottom 99% with 1% of the money. It doesn't work that way. And yet that's what these elitists are going for. So let me ask you a big question. So given what you've been looking into in terms of Satan worship and the left and the Paul Harvey thing, what do you think motivates the left? Why do you think they want to do what they do?
Well, I think there's two things. I think some leftists, you know, especially with like corporations and stuff, are just in it, you know, because they want to be woke so they can kind of like fit in, I guess. Like it's kind of like a club, you know. You know, who can out
woke
each
club?
Other, you know.
I bet you have something called the woke
so,
club.
So
okay.
So for instance, with Bernie Sanders, in 2016, Bernie Sanders ran fairly moderate on issues like race, guns, immigration, things like that. Because, and I think that's where he is at his heart. He's focused on class issues, not, you know, and we could debate the basis.
He's a Marxist.
He's not really focused on, like, yeah, exactly. but I would argue, that the old Marxism is better than this neo-race Marxism now, if I had to choose between the two.
Oh, wait, and, stop right there. This is, no, hold on, this is fascinating. So old Marx, I'm taking notes right away here. So old Marxism versus modern woke, I can't even say it. I hate the word woke because, first of all, it's a past tense. It drives me crazy because grammatically, it sucks. You know, I'm not woke.
Yeah.
You know, I was woken, but you can't be woke. It's not a noun any more than you can grow the economy. It's not like it's a plant or something. You can make the economy grow. But the destruction, and of course the word fewer has almost gone out of existence. So modern woke Marxism. Oh, go ahead and define those two for me. I'm curious.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and define the modern woke Marxism. So basically it originates from the Frankfurt School of Thought. So during World War II,
No, go ahead.
Marxist professors at the school in Frankfurt in Germany. And when Hitler came to power, you know, they realized that they needed to get out of there because they were, you know, probably going to be put in camps and things like that. And so they got out and they came. Yeah, killed. So they came over here to America. Mm-hmm. And they were Marxist, socialist, you know, Trotskyites, a lot of them that came over. And, you know, that's where we get the intersectionality from. So it was actually these people that theorized a lot of this stuff. Basically, they combined the Marxist class struggle and then just added other, you know, what they viewed as oppressed groups to it. So, you know, the feminism, black power, gay power, all this stuff. That's where a lot of these ideologies actually come from. They're very influential. Not a lot of people know about that, but no, they were very influential on like the modern social progressivism, the philosophical basis for it. That's where it originated from. Like all this, intersectionality, things like that. That's where all those ideas originate from.
Define that. That sounds like a nice little made up word. Intersectionality. It's like synchronicity. What is intersectionality? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's the belief that all these different oppressed categories, they all like intersection at certain points. It's like all these groups need to unite to, you know, fight against the oppressing class, which instead of being the bourgeoisie, it's the, you know, white, cisgendered, heterosexual
white Christian males.
Yeah, white Christian males, yeah.
Yeah, we're the oppressors.
It's basically the new bourgeoisie. So instead of having the bourgeoisie, it's the white Christian male.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I've heard that before too. In fact, Claire, before she left the show, talked about this, about the Chinese have done this, and then the Russians have done this. If you want to screw up American society, you know, use its own values against itself, because Americans want to be fair, want to be equal, don't want to be racist, and aren't, you know, except for the exceptions. And that could be black racist, white racist, Asian racist. Anybody can be a racist. But the point is that most people, you know, we go about our daily lives where, especially when I was in the Bay Area, surrounded by, you know, every race, you know, only two genders. I don't care what people say. Multiple ethnicities, languages. I mean, I heard Russian spoken and then, you know, Hindi and then, you know, English and then, you know, French. And I mean, just walking on the streets in San Francisco, you know, and various Asian languages and various, you know, and then you got Spanish, Portuguese, things like that. So you got all these different languages and ethnic groups and everybody coming together. And for the most part, we get along just fine. You know, but when once it comes to policy, there was a speaker on One American News who was talking about the alphabet mafia, you know, talking about, you know, the LGBTQ, BLM, you know, all the different groups that all have little acronyms and call them the alphabet mafia. And it's the segregation, the resegregation of America into these political minorities that want their own special rights. That you can't do that. If you've got equal protection by the 14th Amendment, you know, if you've got, you know, the whole idea that we are equal under the law and that your rights, you know, only go as far as, you know, where my rights start, then you can't have special rights for anybody. Affirmative action, for example, is an unconstitutional policy. Lowering standards for certain racial groups on standardized tests or things like that is an unconstitutional policy. You know, having, you know, creating marriage when marriage means between a man and a woman licensed by the state, well, you know, sanctioned by God, licensed by the state, you know, and the Supreme Court says, well, we're just going to create a new category. No, you can't. You've now destroyed marriage for everybody under the classic definition. And so the idea of these arrogant groups and their own little selfishness can sort of proclaim what they want, tell businesses what they can do, tell people what they can do, tell people what they can believe, if otherwise they're not woke, and then, you know, do a character assassination to force them to believe, you know, that's your Marxism. So, woke. What does woke mean to you and your friends? When you guys talk about being woke, what's the latest incarnation?
Well, you know, basically like how the progressives would describe it is just being, well, especially for white people, would be being aware of like your white, being aware of your privilege, basically, and how your privilege harms, you know, oppressed people.
Oh, but what if I believe that the term white privilege, white nationalist, white supremacist is an incredibly offensive, if not racist term that nobody should be using right now? Every bit as bad as the N-word, a bit as bad as if someone was talking about black supremacists, which I use the word now because everybody's talking, you know, folks are talking about white supremacists. So I feel perfectly, you know, comfortable saying black supremacists. In fact, we did a show on it. But this idea that, you know, that's not offensive. And it's like certain words are offensive, you know, if you say, you know, black nationalist, black supremacist. And I'm surprised the left hasn't, you know, picked up on this. But the idea that white people need to start saying that the term white nationalist, white supremacist, and this whole concept of white privilege is BS. You know, there are rich white people and there are poor white people, you know, as a white immigrant to this country, you know, who had no privilege, who had no immigrant group, who had no color-based group to help me out. I can tell you right now, there ain't no damn white privilege for white immigrants. It doesn't exist, you know. So anyway, but So do you run into woke people, you know, in your friends or dealings or just, you know, interaction with the world?
Not, I mean, on the internet, but not really too much, like, at school, for instance, just because of the nature of the school that I go to, you know, being a, you know, private Christian school in the South. So it does tend to be fairly conservative on most issues, including this one. And that is definitely the prevailing. Like, you go into a university, for instance, like a public university, that's what most of the students there are going to be thinking. You know, at least most of the liberal students on race, that's what they're going to be thinking.
Yeah, but I think so much of this has to be taught. It's really incredible. Anyway, I want to get Gene in the conversation too. Gene, feel free to join in here. We've only got a few more minutes with Dave, and then we're going to get to Cindy. We're going to hear what the latest in medical freedom. But you know, especially with this is why I want to show on the show for you know high school, college, for what's being taught in the schools. You know, it seems to me that the government schools are creating racists. You know, they're creating racists. Mm-hmm. You know, against. You know, the white people, but I never identify as white unless it's thrown in my face. I mean, I don't think about it until someone says white privilege, because I know they mean me. You know, I say, what the hell are you talking about? You know, I don't go through my life, you know, or through my day thinking about my whiteness. It never occurs to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, that's because you're not woke. You know, if you were black, you'd feel black every minute of the day. Well, really? Well, let's, you know, I mean, we had a really interesting interview yesterday with Pianki's grandson, Quentin. who was on the line, who's my early 20s, and just gave a fabulous perspective. But he, a lot of times, you know, said he's a young black conservative. And it was like, but that's, and it's interesting that that's so much of the identity. It's like, dude, you're just a conservative. It's okay. You know, anyway,
yeah.
Do you go through your day in whiteness?
No, I really think race, you know, they always talk about like gender being a social construct. I think we need to start viewing race as more of a social, especially for when you're trying to have like a united country. It's really not helpful to have all these, like the balkanization of America, like all these tiny little ethnic groups, you know, trying to compete and whatever. Like we just need to, we're all one American people, you know, and I think that's kind of what we need to go back to.
Not as long as you're hyphenated. You know, As long as people divide themselves. Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt. Yeah, in fact, One American News says they have a little thing at 5 o'clock in the morning, talking about after I've been awake for an hour. God, I can't believe it. But they talk about, you know, Teddy Roosevelt said, anybody that wants to come to this country to assimilate and become an American, great, we're going to welcome you with open arms. But you have to come here to become an American. You can't come here bringing your allegiances to other countries. Now, I came here as a Canadian, you know, and I still identify as, you know, partly Canadian, but I don't have allegiance to Canada. You know, allegiance to this country, and I swore allegiance to this country to become a citizen of this country. Doesn't mean I can make the distinction between leaving, you know, Canada as my place of birth and a, you know, an honor place where Canada will always consider me a citizen of Canada, and I honor that, okay? But my allegiance is this country. This is why I'm here. This is why, you know, the opportunities are here. The ability to change, you know, citizen legislation would not happen in Canada. It has to happen here. This is the land of opportunity, the land of change, and the land of big things happening. And so this is the place to be. It's really quite interesting. All right. We got a few minutes left here before Cindy joins us. Anything else or what else should we cover here? It's great talking to you, by the way.
I mean,
this is fun.
Yeah, no, it was nice talking to you, too. I mean, I think we covered everything, really. I got to go to school soon. So.
Okay.
It was nice coming on.
Well, thank you. Do you want to give your YouTube channel or any information so people can find what you're doing?
Yeah, my YouTube channel is The Schneier Show, S-C-H-N-E-I-E-R. If you want to subscribe, please do. I'll be definitely uploading more within the next, especially over winter break. But we'll be putting out the new videos soon.
Yeah. Okay. Have a great day in school, and thanks for calling. And we'll do it again next week. Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
Have a good
day. All right. Bye. You take care. Here we go. Gene, that was fast. This was great. Dave's fairly young, and so this is why, you know, he sounds a lot more mature than he is, but, you know, Dave's still in school, and it's great to have him on because I want to get more and more younger folks on the show just for the point of view. Talk about an articulate, you know, young dude. I mean, he does a great job.
Yeah, that he does.
Yeah. So
and
how you doing?
And it is nice to get their point of view, and it's also nice, you know, because he is younger, and they see things differently than we do because, you know, just their life experience. Some may say it's not tainted. Some may say it's just, So it's really neat. Yeah.
Dave's interesting. I think he's been homeschooled and now he's in a private school. I don't know if he has, you know, much government school experience, but I think the difference is you'll find with people that are homeschooled and private schooled that, especially since he goes to, you know, a fairly conservative school, it makes a big difference. He doesn't have that indoctrination, but I'm sure he knows people who do. And it's such a difference, you know, and we're raising generations of idiots who are politically woke, but intellectually stupid. And it's a really dangerous thing. And I'm worried about that entire generation, you know, of our younger folks, the, you know, the high school, college age crowd, simply because I think we're, you know, they've been done a terrible injustice in getting a political indoctrination and no real education. But yet the elites reserve to themselves the real education, as we've talked about before. You know, with the Phillips Exeter Academy, you know, all the places that the elites go to school. It's really quite interesting. Anyway, do you have some news or thoughts this morning? I want to take a break here in just a couple of minutes, but I want to sort of get some topics out there and see if you have things. Because I'm going to check out Cindy too and see if she's going to be checking in with us as well. Big topic on your mind?
This really isn't news, but Biden was in Minnesota yesterday. I didn't even know that. At a community college in Rosemont. And so I was just reading something a little while ago that said that the students were from this VOTEC were sent out an email like 3 in the morning telling them that classes were canceled. they bust people in for this time when he was there. And supposedly no one knew he was coming, or they didn't put anything out that he was coming because they didn't want protests. And there still were your people, Trump supporters, that were saluting him on the way through. But just,
saluting
just
him?
Interesting.
Which finger?
That, well, saying, you know, the Biden, you know, whatever. But it's just, and I know sometimes they, all politicians do that. I mean, bust people in to make it look good, whatever, whatever. But I mean, how sad, because the reason I say that is, regardless if you like him or not, if he comes to your area, would you go see him? You know, and as,
him?
A, as
no.
A young student, would you go, I mean, young adult, not a young student, but a young adult, would you go see him just to say, hey, I saw, you know, President Biden or what? Yeah, whatever, doesn't matter. But it's like I never was the type of person that appreciated or respected things or people that weren't honest and truthful, and this is just another show of that. It's just really sad. It's just like, are you kidding me? But that's what happened.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I love seeing President Trump just because it was fun. I don't need to see him again, because watching him in real life, you know, the TV monitor, you know, the is so good. Of course, we all have big screen TVs now. So back when you and I were kids, you know, the TVs were smaller, you know, when you saw somebody live, like larger than life. But now with big screen TVs that we've had the last, you know, I guess 20 years, whatever, you look at, I was watching a rally thinking, you know, this looks damn close to what I just saw on TV like a couple of weeks ago at a rally. And so I never felt the need to go to more than one Trump rally, simply because now I've seen him in real life. And the people that go there every time hear pretty much the same speech. It's amazing that he can give it, but it's more amazing that people can listen to it. I find that fascinating. But it is fun to see celebrities, you know, in real life and realize that, you know, they're people too.
I think in Trump's case, and I could be speaking wrong because I've never been to one of his rallies, but what
I get
from people that have been to him is the how much he loves his country. And just his energy. And I think that's what they like about it, is based on what they've said, are those two things.
Well, he's so different than every other politician, because he talks to people, not at them. He loves his country as opposed to loving his power. He's not one of the elite, arrogant, you know, the opposite, you know, I'd point to in the gelding old party would be a Mitt Romney. You know, you look at Mitt Romney, who was so arrogant, so contentious of regular people. You looked at him, he was always looking down at everybody. You know, I'm the ruler, I'm in charge, I'm, you know, a major capitalist, I have lots of money, I'm powerful, listen to me. You know, of course, his leadership, there wasn't leadership, it was you know, elitism, you know, and the globalism. He was like one of the worst, but he's up there with like the Bushes and the, you know, some of the other elites, not just of the Republican Party, but the elites in general, you know, that think they can run anything. And Trump comes along, America first, as opposed to America last. He's for building this country, not destroying it. And you look at everything that the elites are now doing, you know, through the Brandon insurrection, and you can see that, you know, everything they do hurts this country. You know, in fact, if the GOP geldings want their talking point for the day, you know, it should be that nothing gets better under Democrats. And you know, they should be saying that every single day. Take a look, everybody. You know, nothing gets better under Democrats. It only gets worse. I mean, there's your campaign slogan for the 2022 midterms. Everything's worse under Democrats. And it's true. You look around. But this is what the elites want for this country. So realizing that they stole the election to ruin this country, you know, is how contemptuous these people are of the people, of the Constitution, of our liberty. They don't care about our liberty. You know, and this is evidenced by Dr. Fascist, you know, as the preeminent person that says, well, your individual rights are subordinate to my view of what's in the public good. Well, who the hell are you, you know, Mr. Dictator? It's funny that Pearson Sharp just started talking about him as Benito Fauci, you know, in reference to, you know, his Italian background and Benito Mussolini, who invented fascism. You know, this is why I call him Dr. Fascist. The reasons for all this kind of stuff. But yeah, the contempt that they have, and Trump comes up, and it's just so different than everybody else. It's really great just to hear his rallies. It looks like Cindy's on the line, so if you want to give me your comment, I think you should go to a rally. I think you'd really enjoy it, personally.
Yeah, I will have to do that one day. But it was just interesting reading that. I'm just everything about him is just so non-genuine and fake. And And that's what's so sad. I'm talking Biden. It's like everything he says, it's just, oh, man. Yikes.
Well, no, you know, this is Obama's term, and there's a whole bunch of people behind him. And no one's been able to identify who they are, which I think is crazy. I mean, it's the former Obama people, the Obama elites, Obama himself. You know, the Afghan surrender was an Obama plan, you know, giving all the weapons to the Taliban to build them up, you know, the build up a Muslim army was an Obama plan, you know, the destruction of our country, the ruining of our energy, the limit of our pipelines, the supplies, the supply chain, the California destruction of the trucking industry, all that stuff is, well, I mean, that's either an Obama plan or a California plan. This is all by design. Nothing that's happening now that is destructive of our liberty, our energy, of our economy is something that wasn't planned. And could easily be reversed because you just look at a year and a half ago before COVID was engineered and brought upon us, we were fine. And they couldn't stand that. Remember, the elitists and the Democrats are, and the deep state is miserable when we're happy. We the people are happy. And they're only happy when we the people are miserable because then they feel like they're in charge. Let's get on to our medical freedom report with Cindy Cagle and see what's going on the cutting edge of medical freedom. He said with a grin. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning. Good morning, Jane. How are you?
Good, thanks.
So
what's going on, darling?
Lots going on in just a couple, week and a half. Mm-hmm. With the reversals, the injunctions, I was really, really excited when the first domino fell and those 10 states were reversed. And then with the nationwide reversal, I think everybody's cautiously optimistic, I guess is the word.
So what does that mean for like healthcare workers? You know, if the company says, well, we're going to keep our policy anyway, screw you, you know, and do you plop the injunction on their desk, the copy of the injunction, and say, oh, here it is, you can't do that. You know, you've already been overruled, you know Mr. Boss, jerk, idiot, you know.
That's a great question, because even as of yesterday, we had someone who was up against, you know, an employer that was pushing this nonsense. So that is yet to be discovered. You would think that everyone would play by the rules and reverse course, but that's not necessarily what's happening. So, while we're celebrating the victories, it's still going to be a fight. As my husband and I were talking last night, you know, the same people are still in charge and, are the ones that are enforcing the illegal stuff, and they're, you know, there's been no consequences. So it's a victory, but we'll see where it carries us.
Well, a couple of things. Are there any enforcement provisions in the injunction? I mean, is there relief? Is there lawsuit capability? Are there civil suits you can bring? You probably can, actually. That's something that Jeff Childress is doing some lawsuit work, you know, with some of these pension folks. You know, is there, with this injunction, is there the ability to go after them civilly? There should be.
You know, that's a good question. I read it, and that doesn't stick out in my mind, but I wasn't looking at it from that point of view because anybody can sue. I mean,
if you have something behind you. I mean, there are frivolous lawsuits all the time. I mean, anybody can sue, but not anybody can get it into court and get it to, you know, get it through the courts and get a victory. So yes, anybody can sue, but you know, you still have to have standing and a reason and some of the other stuff to bring about a lawsuit. But yeah.
Well, based on the language that the judge used, it seems very obvious that what's been done is unconstitutional, and he outlined why it was unconstitutional, and you don't have to be a lawyer to figure that out. But I think, the path to legally pursue this and win, and I don't know that there's really been any doubt in Childers' mind or Crossland, you know, the attorneys that are taking this stuff on, that there's any doubt in their mind that they will win. It's just, you know, we shouldn't have to be going down that road. So I think what's been done with the injunctions just kind of confirms that and lays the groundwork to the victory that everyone knows will come. It's just the fact that you have to spend the resources and the time to do it.
Oh yeah, I mean, what's done, you know, whether it's on, it's a, well, it's, I got an article here from WEAR TV, W-E-A-R, ABC Channel 3, which says Louisiana from their affiliate WICS/WRSP, it's getting complicated, a national COVID-19 vaccine mandate for thousands of healthcare workers has been put on hold by a federal judge. Justeri Doughty, D-O-U-G-H-T-Y, or Doughty, granted a preliminary injunction to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Yes, yeah, this is, I want to talk to you about this. This is really important. And there was a mandate from Tuesday. The CMS policy states that any employee of a facility that participates in Medicaid or Medicare must be, quote, fully vaccinated, whatever that means, by January 4th, 2022, with no testing option available. Oh, isn't that nice? It requires Medicare and Medicaid health provider staff members to receive one COVID vaccine dose by December 6th. Okay, then they would need the second one by January 4th. Well, isn't that special? Well, here's the thing that I think is the key here. This Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Brandon's insurrection seems to be going around the Constitution and around openly, you know, the original mandates were blocked by the Fifth Circuit in Louisiana. So then they said, okay, we couldn't go by OSHA and get people over 100, you know, companies with over 100 people. We couldn't do that. So then they said, let's go through this funding agency that reimburses, you know, virtually every health provider in the country, because I think virtually every health provider in the country has Medicare or Medicaid patients. So they said, we're not going to allow, you know, people to do it. And then, of course, they went after the federal contractors. In other words, anybody that works for a business that does any business with the federal government, which, of course, is, you know, like half the population of the country. So let's take those three cases. So the one that we're talking about here, Medicare and Medicaid Services, the CMS, a group that I have, you know, gotten more contempt for by the day. The fact that they, because they pay out, we need some legislation to restrict them to simply paying the bills and stop getting involved in policy. That's not their business. Federal government has no business in health policy simply because the Constitution doesn't allow them any business in health. In fact, Medicare, Medicaid is unconstitutional on its face just because of that. So tell me about this CMS group, this Center for Medicaid, Medicare, you know, and are they the ones behind this, and are they paying off your various employers and healthcare, big hospitals, you know, the various doctor's offices and things like that, or are they just withholding money that should go to Medicare and Medicaid, you know, expenses? How you know, and it does the injunction stops the Medicaid folks from doing that. That's what it looks like to me. So it's not a prohibition on your employer from a policy. It's a prohibition on the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services from withholding money to enforce an illegal vaccine mandate. That's what it looks like to me. How am I doing?
That's my understanding. And there is no, I mean, even the administration hasn't put anything in writing to direct employers to do this. They're working off of a suggestion that was made by the president that CMS took and ran with. It's basically CMS pulling the strings, manipulating employers to do their bidding. Mm-hmm. And these injunctions have called them out on it and reminded them that, A, that's unconstitutional, And B, based on some of the language that the attorney or the judge used, he really did take the credibility of them and the NIH, you know, pointed out that their science and their tactics really take away from what they are as institutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a fascinating, you know, bureaucratic mess that the insurrection is causing. But here's the thing too: you can't expect legal mandates from an illegal administration. You know, when they come to power by stealing the White House, they've lost all credibility, but they've also lost all accountability because they're already illegal. So the idea that an illegal, you know, group, you know, in Washington is going to do anything legal, they have no reason to. They have no guilt, no compunction about violating the law because they already violated the law just getting there.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you look at it that way, you know, do you, the Constitution, you know, the Supreme Court ruled a while back, well, actually they opined, they can't really rule, but they opined a while back that any law that's unconstitutional literally doesn't exist. Okay. So in that respect, a government that was stolen doesn't exist either. So we actually have no government. So, you know, it'd be interesting to bring a lawsuit on that fact. It'd be interesting, you know, or at least say, look, this current insurrection is under an ongoing investigation. So how is it they can make any mandates? I mean, I don't know if that's ever been tried legally. It'd be an interesting thing to take a look into. But the bigger point is that CMS, the Center for Medicare Systems Funding, is huge. And I got the article continues here. This is a CMS mandate covers 76,000 medical facilities and 17 million. Employees nationwide, including nursing homes. Mm. 17 million. That's a hell of a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, that's several big cities. Yeah, Gene, come on in. What's up?
And just so you know, this just didn't happen now. This has been in the talk for months and months and months. So mm-hmm. I think this was all part of a plan or their plan to make sure people got vaccinated.
Yeah. Well, this is what I'm wondering, too, is are they trying to get as many people shot up with COVID, you know, to, if you pardon the expression, to make as much money as possible? I mean, you know, we'll talk about the NIH Moderna battle over profits in a minute. But, you know, are they doing these mandates knowing full well they're going to be illegal just to get as many people shot up so they can maximize their profits? And that includes the government profits? Or do they actually sincerely believe in these things, that they're doing the right thing? Or both? No. I mean, are they totally corrupt, or are they totally immoral, or are they true believers in something insane? Gene?
I think they really just wanted a way to force people to get the vaccination. That's okay. What I believe. I don't think they're not interested in our health and well-being. If they are, they would have allowed people to get the treatments that work instead of banishing them, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, you can't tell me that this OSHA, those regulations and this, that was all planned. They said, well, and Biden and his administration, just the whole, whoever works there, I don't think they have a clue morally what's right and wrong, because they don't think they ever do anything wrong.
Yeah, it's arrogance, moral arrogance. Cindy, what do you think?
Yeah. Sorry, I was going through the coffee and COVID, looking at the perspective of a lawyer, and yeah, he's been calling, Jeff Childers has been calling this for over a year and a half on mm-hmm. why there is no legal standing for this.
Well, just to blow our own horn, he's a little late to the party. We were talking about this in February of 2020. In fact, I had I found a resolution that I wrote demanding that Congress spend half their money on killing the damn virus and only half the money on vaccines. So just to let – and we had Jeff Gertz from the – no, Bill Gertz, excuse me, from the Washington Times on. So – and I'd like to get Jeff on the show, quite frankly. In fact, you know, if you're working with him or know him, invite him on. But just, you know, I mean, we call this the cutting edge of freedom for you know, I try not to blow our own horn here too often, but quite frankly, we were way out there. I had the Dr. Raoult study from Marseille, France on March 2nd of 2020. We declared that there was no pandemic, that we had a cure. We had all this information already. We were, you know, and then Dr. Zelenko came out and we broadcast that. And so, yeah, we've been doing this going on 2 years, you know, close to, well, actually March of next year. So I'm not trying to, you know, saying against Jeff. Jeff's a great lawyer, but it's just kind of funny that, you know, once we get our million listeners, this will be a lot easier for us here to get the word out. But quite frankly, you know, and not only that, but we have the bills. We have bills to put full product liability back on the vaccine manufacturers. We have two bills that would totally change what's going on in the state, because what the state put out in the special legislative session, quite frankly, is inadequate. You know, it still allows for mandatory vaccines. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and think mm-hmm. about how things might have played out if these employers weren't given the immunity that they were right off the bat.
How are employers immune?
Well, they're immune from liability, medical liability. So for all these employees that they've been pushing the vaccine on, have they have no recourse against their employer for the adverse – reactions of that shot because of the protections afforded to those employers. That in itself, if that wasn't in place, I wonder how many of these employers would have been mandating their employees to get the shot.
Well, I want to explore that a bit because, as I understand it, the vaccine manufacturers have no liability because they go to the VAERS system, you know, because the Congress, in their infinite stupidity, thought that it'd be better to get vaccines on the market faster, you know, with less liability, or actually with no liability, you know, so they could compete with, I guess, foreign vaccine manufacturers. A bunch of crap, you know. It's a totally obscene law that I'm obviously going to repeal. In fact, we have the means to do that if enough people would, you know, share and get into the media and get into Congress, and we'll start screaming and yelling about it. So the means, the bill is there. Just need the means to get it out there. But how are employers? Are they covered under the emergency use authorization? How come they're not liable if they mandate something that say kills, you know, worst case scenario, that you know, employee who is refusing it says, okay, I'll take it just to please you, so you know, I'm not going to fight this anymore. I'm going to get shot up with COVID, and they end up dying. You know, doesn't their family have recourse to sue the employer for mandating something that was dangerous, or are they protected under the emergency use authorization, so the employers have no liability whatsoever? And if they have no liability, then you shouldn't comply with them because they have no liability. I mean, I'm helping
you.
You
know,
out.
That's interesting that you're asking me that. And in full disclosure, I don't know where I'm coming up with that thought process. It's my understanding that employers don't have any liability at this point, and maybe that isn't the case, that everybody's thinking like I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where I got that impression. And maybe
that is how half the law is done in this country. People think that the Supreme Court can issue a decision on Roe v. Wade and make it national policy, and that's absolute BS. We're going to prove that later in the show. There's a lot of assumptions that are out there that the Supreme Court, you know, can determine what constitutional rights are. That's BS too. The assumptions are, you know, one of the strongest things we talk about on this show is that assumptions are stronger than truth. People will go to the grave defending their assumptions, however bad they are. And there's so many things that people know to be true that really aren't. They're only assumptions. So this is why I question things. Now, I don't question this to put you on the spot, but more to send you on a passive investigation.
I'll tell you, that's my homework for today.
Exactly.
I am going to immediately look into that when I get off the show.
Well, let us know next week. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I think Jean has a comment. There's our hotel bell. So this is Jean's nice way of telling me she has a comment. The stronger way is when we get the gong. So when we get the gong, it's like, oh, yeah, they're going to
I won't
right
take
away.
It personal then if I get a gong.
No, don't take it personal. It's more for me. Jean?
No, it's just to say, take a breath. I got something to say. No, I think you're right. Because I've heard there's no recourse by many people, that there's no recourse if you get the vaccine and some – you have an ill side effect. But really, if you get the vaccine and something happens, that should be workman's comp. Because even though you weren't injured by something, well, you really were injured on the job because they made you do that, number one. And number two, they should, if a sentinel accident happens or occurrence happens in a hospital healthcare facility where an ill, like someone dies or you go to surgery and someone, you know, they take out the wrong or cut off the wrong leg, amputate the wrong leg or whatever they do the wrong surgery on the wrong knee, whatever. You have to, you know, send that information into the government. They keep track of that stuff. So what I'm getting at is, okay, if someone has an adverse effect from the vaccine, that should be reported. And if they die, there should be recourse. There's no reason why there shouldn't be, because if a person otherwise wouldn't have gotten the vaccine and they only got it because their employer mandated it.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
But as I said, yeah, because I was told there's no recourse.
And I know with the, or I believe I heard with the latest injunction that there are states that have moved to make that a possibility, to make workers' compensation available to employees that are adversely affected. But my knowledge to date is that isn't the case anywhere, and states are moving to make that possible. But
yeah, I don't
there's
think
a
that
lot
came out of
the
new Florida legislation, for example. I mean, that's part of the inadequacy, you know. But the problem is, you don't want, and this is a life changing or a life ending
exactly
situation.
I mean,
so
little comfort.
Yeah, you don't want to try and get restitution at the back end. You want prevention at the front end. You know,
right.
In other words, not to take in the first place.
Right.
Well, it'd be interesting if you actually go to some health employer bosses, you know, Mr. and Ms. Bean Counter, and say, excuse me, you know, Mr. and Ms. Bean Counter, what are you getting out of this? You know, do you have liability? Are you making extra money? I mean, I would just ask them directly. In fact, I may ask them directly.
Oh,
I may do it myself. You know,
but they are going to tell you that.
Yeah, you're not going to give you.
Oh, heck no.
No, I just want to see their face. I just. You know me. I'm interested in the reaction, but you know, I'll do a pull of 60 minutes on them when they were good. Speaking of which, did you folks ever see? I had this post on my site, the 60 minutes piece on the swine flu vaccine that Mike Wallace did back in the 70s. It's fascinating. It's the same CDC. It's the same propaganda. It's the same misinformation. Mm-hmm. It's the same. You know, they talk about celebrities getting this, and you know, and they said, you know, and Mary Tyler Moore was extremely popular in the 70s with her Mary Tyler Moore show, and they said Mary Tyler Moore got the vaccine. So Mike Wallace goes to Mary Tyler Moore. Did you get the vaccine? He says, no. She says, did you give them permission to use your name saying you did? She says, no, of course not. You know, it's right on my Facebook page. So, you know, but you can look it up. 60 Minutes, Mike Wallace, swine flu, you know, vaccine report. And so they're lying through the teeth then. They're lying through the teeth. It's the exact same lies. You know, it's just it's a new marketing tool. You know, it's COVID this time as opposed to swine flu. But these things are all engineered, you know, and the idea that your natural immunity doesn't work, but there's no profit in natural immunity. See, that's the biggest problem too. But I'd be curious, either employers are losing money because of CMS Medicaid funding, or they're gaining money because of like the 20% bonus with remdesivir. You know, they get extra money for putting people. Yeah. So what's the latest on that? Have you heard from, you know, your sources out there?
Well, I've heard, and I don't have concrete evidence, but I've been pointed in directions that indicate they are profiting off of this. There's incentives to get everybody vaccinated. There's incentives to use drugs like remdesivir. And that in itself should scare everyone and should be illegal. And as my husband and I were discussing last night, that's the part that concerns us with what is happening that seems to be moving in our favor, is that you do still have these institutions that are financially benefiting from, you know, CMS calling the shots and dictating how they use protocols. What's going to happen if those profits aren't received or they stop being funneled into the hospitals? It's pretty difficult for hospitals to turn away from, you know, the profits that they're seeing.
Well, that's for the bean counters. You know, hospital, we've talked about this before, hospitals aren't run by doctors anymore or nurses. They're run by bean counters, by managers, by MBAs and other people that, you know, the same people that back with the Ford Pinto decided it was worth saving $9, you know, by not moving the gas tank up a few inches, you know, per car. That the lawsuits for the loss of life for people who were burned up in a fiery crash in the backseat of a Pinto, you know, they would save money by leaving the gas tank where it was and losing, you know, a couple thousand people. You know, it was cheaper than spending $9 per Pinto to move the gas tank. That's the kind of calculation that bean counters make. That's why they're called bean counters. You know, it's cost-benefit analysis, and life has no value. You know,
and
so
Pfizer
has
a track record of that very same thought process.
Well, aren't they the most... find, in other words, don't they have the greatest assessments against them of virtually any company anywhere in the world? Haven't they been assessed for billions of dollars of fines for breaking the law? I mean, this is a company that's being pushed on everybody right now.
I don't know if they hold the first place prize for it, but I know that they have made very calculated decisions about medicine for people that are based financially. They're not based on, you know, science and medicine.
So the cost of death is lower than the profit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and this is the other thing with remdesivir. There's no cost. You know, ventilators kill 97% of the people that go on them. Well, any product that killed 97% of the users would be immediately banned.
Yeah.
There'd be lawsuits up the wazoo. The company would be bankrupt literally in seconds, you know, and all their assets and their personal assets, and the people would never work again. You know, can you imagine if smoking killed 97% of the people, you know, within 24 hours of using the product? How long do you think we'd have cigarettes, you know, in this country? Not long, all right? But yet ventilators, you know, kill, their track record is 97%. So you get remdesivir, which destroys your kidneys, and then somehow you get, I think it's called a pulmonary edema, that your kidneys, you know, stop, you know, getting fluid out of your body. So fluid, I hate to think of it as the same fluid, goes into your lungs, and then they put people on ventilators to try and blow that fluid out, you know? Mm. And I got experience with this because I had fluid in my lungs. I almost suffocated to death 3 weeks after heart surgery. They drained the fluid. Now, why they're not draining the fluid out of these people, they're putting them on a ventilator, I don't know. That doesn't make any sense to me because, you know, I had drained 4.5 liters of fluid, which is a hell of, take 2 liter bottles, two liter bottles. Mm. Okay. Folks, of your favorite soft drink, and add another, you know, half a liter on top of that. That's what they took out of my chest.
Good night.
That's a hell of a lot of fluid. Yeah. Go ahead, Gene.
I got a comment though. This is so ludicrous though, because if you think about it, why, you know, that when people go in the hospital or even to get admitted to the hospital, insurance often won't pay for a lot of procedures. They say that's not warranted. It's not justified. Mm-hmm. How can they be willing to pay for remdesivir, people then being put on ventilators, the cost of it versus ivermectin and stuff like that? Why? I mean, it don't make any sense. It's who is in control of that. It's like where is the medical professionals? I'm talking the doctors, that they're not speaking out more. And I know some of them aren't because they're afraid of their license and whatever. But
I think that's most of them.
If they would speak out in the masses, then that would be a moot point, because how can they go after all, you know, not all of them, but a big number of them? But,
well, that's a great segue into HB House Bill 687. A lot of these doctors aren't speaking up because of the retaliation, the threats that they're receiving from their credentialing boards to silence them or take their medical license. Dr. John Ward helped write the bill, HB 687, for that very purpose, to protect healthcare workers from being retaliated and their medical licenses taken or suspended. We don't have that protection in place for them, and it's preventing them from speaking up. So that's huge to get that passed. Sadly, it's just on a state level at this point, but like the injunctions, I think if you get one state to enact it, you know, everything else will fall in place. But that's why. It's because I've seen some of the letters that they're receiving, and it's disgusting. It is basically these bureaucratic agencies dictating how doctors practice medicine, and especially when it comes to COVID.
Yeah, and another disgusting thing is Fauci. So many people are saying that the medical professionals, the doctors, a lot of them are appalled by how he has been, how he handled this COVID stuff. And how sad is that he's still considered like the guru of it in this country for some people. And it's like, when is he going to start being held accountable?
Boy, that's a great question. I don't know how people... Last night I was gathering information about his stance on masks and how it's, you know, changed back and forth over the last year and a half. And even as recently as 2 months ago, I believe, I'm doing this from memory, but, you know, he was talking about, well, yeah, I guess outside we can agree that it's not really necessary to have a mask on, but you still need to be socially distanced. And then as of yesterday, he's back out with, you know, we're this is a lifelong situation, and you know, obviously pushing the vaccine, but telling people, you know, that they need to be wearing masks when they're visiting with their family and whatnot. It's just, it's incredible that he has any platform to...
Exactly.
No, but he serves a function.
I mean, you're supposed to wear a mask in your own house in some places. It's like, are you kidding me? That's...
Yeah.
I mean, how sad.
Now, Dr. Fascist, the genocidal, psychopathic, narcissistic vaccine drug pusher, serves a purpose. He is the minister of propaganda and fear. He is the science behind the communist manifesto that's going on here. He is the justification. He is the one that explains, you know, why you're all afraid. I mean, he creates the fear through the explanations. He serves a very valuable function for the Marxist takeover of our government. I mean, it's very simple. He's there for a very specific purpose. Now Trump should have fired his ass, and he should have been up
he
on
should.
Charges for withholding life-saving medical information, for banning the cures that he knew worked. And we know he knew he worked, because he knew back in 2005 that hydroxychloroquine killed SARS-CoV-1. And SARS-CoV-1, is you know, until it was gain of function enhanced into SARS-CoV-2, is 72% of the same genome. Of course, there are those that say they can't find, they haven't isolated it yet, and I want to get some folks on that too. But no, this is all part of the plan. He is there, you know. There were Ed Asner, and one of the few smart things he said way back when, and he's like ultra liberal. He says, "Art upsets, science reassures." And when you think about it, the duty of art is to upset you. It's to like, you ever see the picture by Picasso of Guernica after the Nazis bombed the Spanish town for no reason whatsoever. And it's a very compelling, amazing picture. It's probably my favorite one of Picasso's, because it is so powerful. Art upsets. That's what it's supposed to do. That's why rock and rebellion and everything else is there, and all the different things. But science reassures. You know, it's and he is there. He's the kindly, fatherly. I mean, he's like Joseph Mengele. And who was the minister of propaganda? Joseph Goebbels. They're both named Joseph. That's interesting. So Mengele and Goebbels kind of rolled into one is Dr. Fascist. That's how I think of him, you know. And so he, you know, because he has no conscience. He is evil incarnate. And he can look at you with a perfectly straight face, lie through his teeth, knowing full well that he owns, you know, I don't know how many dozens of patents on the very things that he's promoting, which is a direct conflict of interest anyway. You know, and here's a question. Just think of the moral... you know, perspective of this, that both Moderna and the National Institute of Health are fighting in court over who patented it first and who's got the rights to all the money. What is that?
And how is that possible? Yeah. I didn't believe that the government could partner with a private company for something like this. So that on its face is problematic. Again, things happening that my layman's understanding aren't supposed to happen in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a Jeff Childress question. This is why I've been trying to reach him. But if you have more contact than I do, let's get him on the show and ask him. That'd be a perfectly good question. How is all this possible?
Yeah, I love the bell.
That's the bell, Jean.
Yeah.
You rang.
No.
You rang.
Yeah.
I'll do it Lurch style. You rang.
Yeah.
For all you Adams Family fans.
But isn't there something we can do? As a country, as a people, it's because, you know, Biden's not going to get Fauci out of there because they're all from the same playbook.
Mm-hmm. That's the Obama playbook, by the way.
Yeah,
why somebody hasn't sued Fauci.
Where's medical malpractice? You know, there's another question, that just to sort of piggyback on Gene's question, but what happened to medical malpractice? You know, why is it that when people die of remdesivir and poisoning and ventilator, you know, abuse, that they're not able to sue the hospitals? Are they, you know, those aren't, unless those are covered by the emergency use authorization too, and there's no liability.
That's my understanding.
Okay, so they, you know, okay. So in other words, there's no consequence for killing your patient. You can still make the money off remdesivir, even though we know it's lethal. You know, at least it didn't kill 53% of the people in the trials. Anyway, Gene, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, no, there doesn't seem to be any recourse over the COVID and how it's treated, yet any other way or reason for a person to possibly die over something that someone may consider not the right treatment, they can sue. So, and the sad thing is with COVID, which is really sad, and I don't know if it's the same now, but I know in the past it was, where when you had someone dying of COVID, because it was COVID, they locked down the hospital. So people, family members could not even go in there.
Yeah.
So how did they know
no
what was going on?
Yeah.
So there's no way of knowing.
Yeah.
And yet the health workers were there day in, day out, being exposed to COVID every single day, and all they had were little masks and things like that. This is before, you know, the alleged vaccinations, the COVID shooting up, you know, started in December of 2020. But you had almost a year of people treating folks, and all of a sudden, and they weren't picking it up. That's the funny part. They weren't, you know, for the most part, they weren't catching it. You know, because they're usually generally, you know, younger, healthier people with direct patient contact, or, you know, and so at least I assume that. But it wasn't being spread. And yet they're demanding vaccines now, you know, which aren't vaccines, you know, long after the fact. So what the hell was happening there? You know, that this wasn't being transmitted as much, and now they're going crazy.
And where were the regulatory boards when we had to wear the same N95 mask for weeks at a time when you're supposed to change it, throw it away after you leave every single person's room and get a new one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's the part of me as a non-medical person. That's the common sense aspect of it that makes me realize how effective the other side has been, because common sense should tell you that in a hospital they're not wearing a mask all day long, the same mask all day long. I mean, if you watch any of the programs about surgeries and whatnot, they're gloving up and masking up for, you know, every situation. They turn their back and they're changing their gloves and their masks. Yet we're pushing the notion that you can wear a cloth mask for days on end, touching it. But I believe it's fear, because if we all used our common sense and based our pushback just on that fact alone, I don't believe we'd be where we're at as a country, but common sense doesn't seem to be reigning.
No, you're absolutely right. There was a survey. I just heard this One American News last night, my go-to news. And I think Alex Berenson was talking about a survey that was done that 25% of the people believe COVID is fatal. I mean, once you get it, you're dead. You know, and that's insane. It's less than 1% of the people, and the people that are actually dying of it, you know, have so many other huge health problems. They're kind of at the end of life's journey anyway, you know, for the most part. And those are the people that get affected by flu. I mean, you know, usually people die of a lot of things all at once because, you know, that's it. That's, you know, that's all the time.
Your body can't, and
that's how it works. But people believe that the vaccine will stop COVID cold, that once you're vaccinated, you'll never get it. And that's not true either. You know, so the biggest thing, not only is there fear, but there's lies. And the myth is out there. And the fear is generated by the misinformation and just kind of piggybacks on itself, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And that's how we end up in this horrendous situation. It's like when now we have the new variant, the Omicron variant that Brandon, the thief in chief, called the Omicron. Yeah, we got the Omicron variant. Well, that's interesting. Was it all directional? That's interesting. The Omicron. Anyway, so we always call it here the mild Omicron variant. And if we can introduce that into the language, every time you say it, the mild Omicron variant, that's hard to say. Mild Omicron variant. There we go. All of a sudden, people, every time you say the word mild in front of Omicron, people go, oh, the mild Omicron variant, you know, variant. If we would do that, that's a talking point for the gelding Republican Party, okay? The GOP, the gelding old party. You know, there's an image. Don't think about it. Anyway, having fun this morning. But this is, words create images, okay? So when I say gelding old party, you know exactly who I'm talking about. You know they're completely ineffective. They're a bunch of, but the same thing, if you just say mild Omicron variant, it's like, oh, because nobody's been hospitalized for this. All the cases that Dr. Cortese saw in South Africa, they weren't hospitalized. They're mild. Every case was mild. You know what? Scratchy throat, a few muscle aches, a little tired. Well, hell, everybody gets that as soon as winter comes in this country. You know.
Well, and I scratch my head that you have four patients with symptoms that are so mild, yet you felt the need to identify or work to identify something else. Mm-hmm. It just, to me, it on a common sense level, it just doesn't sound right.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't. No, I mean,
call me a conspiracy theorist, but
I reject that term, conspiracy theorist. You know, you can talk about a conspiracy or you can talk about a theory, but putting them together just brings up a derogatory image in people's minds. So you are not a conspiracy theorist, unless you're theorizing
about
a particular conspiracy.
The first thing that came
conspiracy.
To my mind is why, what mm-hmm. made you pursue looking for something different when the Delta variant is what we're all apparently dying from, and you had somebody with very mild cold-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it, except
well,
to
here's
push
what I know about
variants. A narrative.
Variants are generally more contagious, but that's not a bad thing, but far less virulent. I think that's how you pronounce it. So in other words, you know, the variations, well, see, here's my theory, okay? There were no variants before the vaccine came out. There was no Delta until until Pfizer and crew, Moderna and AstraZeneca in Europe, pushed people into getting, shooting up COVID into their arms. Okay, there were no variants because the variants come from these shots because they only protect against the Alpha strain, the original strain of COVID, and a virus comes along and says, well, if they're only protecting for the Alpha strain, I don't have to deal with natural immunity because that's been suppressed by the alleged vaccine. Okay, so it suppresses it in order to allow for your body to accept the messenger RNA to teach your body about COVID. It's like a long way. It's like going, you know, it's like trying to, you know, turn from north to east by going by west and south. Okay? You're going three quarters of the way out of your way to go east, whereas your natural immunity just points east from north. Oh, there it is. Let's go get it. You know, so your natural immunity already covers everything that this so-called vaccine is trying to do, and it has to do it the long way. It has to suppress your natural immunity in order for you to accept the messenger RNA to teach your body how to fight COVID when your natural immunity already knows how to fight COVID. So it's inherently irrational on its face. Go ahead.
I look at it from a very simple scenario that you have patients come in that are complaining of not feeling well, mm-hmm. and COVID is the answer to everybody's symptoms at this point. So you have four people come into your doctor's office complaining that they're not feeling well, have symptoms mm-hmm. that mimic even just a minor cold, but our reflex is to test for COVID with a PCR test that we know is going to tell you have COVID if you have any of those symptoms. What made the leap from the PCR test that's going to tell you, yeah, you've got the Delta variant, whether it's the Delta variant or not, but what made the leap from the PCR test that would have told them they had COVID to doing some additional research and within, you know, a very short amount of time being able to suspect and then identify that it's something other than the Delta variant? It just...
Well, have any, and just to add to that, have any of these variants had their genomes published? Does anybody, could you recognize a variant if you tripped
yeah.
over it? Would you know what it is or what it was? And is the PCR test, which really only tests for cold and flu viruses, that's what it does. You know, it doesn't, I mean, COVID is a myth. I mean, that's why they get all these false positives. They have to ratchet it up like 30 times. They have to magnify it so many times that, you know, yeah.
Wouldn't they have tested positive for COVID regardless of the variant? We don't have a PCR test that's identifying Delta versus Alpha mm-hmm. and Omega and
yeah, we don't
all
have a shot for
other...
it either. You know,
so,
you can't go get Delta COVID shot. You can't go get the Omicron COVID shot. You can't do it.
Yeah.
They don't exist. You can't even get the approved COVID shot because they haven't made it yet. It's still,
and
you know,
and
still
by the way, we
the,
now have our first case of
yeah.
Omicron in the States. Everything has moved very quickly for some new identity that...
Yeah, I'll tell you what happened, though. Here's what happened.
I think we all know why it happened. It's to push a narrative that's been going on for a year and a half.
Yeah, yeah. It's the latest in the marketing technique. This is all about marketing and making money. I think it happened specifically because those three court cases and now the expansion beyond the 10 states, you know, the mandates have been ruled unconstitutional very quickly. I don't think they expected this to happen this fast. They usually expect some kind of a case to be initiated, and then it goes forward, then it gets appealed, then it goes to the Supreme Court, and that can take like a couple of years. All right. But the fact that the injunctions were put on this immediately, and now they're going forward with the cases. All right. So they locked them up in the front end. That's the first reason I think they have the mild Omicron variant. The second reason I think is because the disease is going, the virus is going away.
You know,
it's not that big a deal anymore. It's going away for like the fourth time. You know,
well,
so
the
mandates failed. The product is not being sold. People aren't afraid of it, so they come up with a new variant. It's just more fear, intimidation, and misinformation. That's why I think.
You know, I struggle with that because going to Tallahassee during the special session, I don't know if it was purely for optics or if it really is the belief there, but Tallahassee seemed to me to be living in an environment that was a year and a half ago about COVID. Very, very fearful, very unaware or at least obviously unwilling to accept that we've learned so much in the last year and a half about COVID. The atmosphere there is very different from what reality is in at least our area of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we're on the cutting edge of what we know and what we feel, but Tallahassee is living in the dark ages for COVID, and whether it's a show or it is because they're uninformed and are living in that type of fear, they've got a long way to go.
I think their sources are bad. I think because they're government people, they rely on government sources, and that's like the worst thing you can do. You know, what they should be relying on is you know, if you mention Dr. Simone Gold or Dr. Zelenko or Dr. Viglione here in Pensacola or Dr. Brian Artis, Ryan Cole, Ben Marble, any of the doctors on the cutting edge of all this stuff, if you mention Jeff Childers, lawyer, I've forgotten the gentleman who was also there at the rally who followed me,
Greg Crossland.
I got to talk to him too. Anyway, but they won't know who these people are. They won't know the information because they're relying on government sources. So they're relying on their own propaganda to try and get truth. And you can't get truth from propaganda. It doesn't work that way.
What have they been throwing down our faces the last year and a half, almost 2 years? Follow the science. They're not following the science.
Well, they're following the government. But here's the interesting thing, though. Governor DeSantis, who's out front of this, who's now doing a really nice job. He's got the blocks on the vaccine mandates, and even from federal contractors and health people and everything else. He's got the blocks on the school boards from mandating masks which don't work and terrorizing the kids. So he's doing a great job. So where the legislature, you know, either they're co-opted by money, they think they have to follow the CDC guidelines, you know, like they're a mandate, which they aren't, and they don't have to follow anything the CDC says. CDC doesn't have any authority over the state government. In fact, they don't have any authority over anybody except at the border. That's the only place they have a legitimate authority because the federal government controls the border.
And they're not flexing it. They're not using their authority at the border.
You got states' rights too. You got 10th Amendment. So it's pretty crazy. Hey, let me play something fun here. Go ahead, Gene or Cindy.
Just going to say that's what was baffling to me is that we've got a governor who is well informed and is making legislation based on that information, yet the climate and the surrounding legislators don't seem to be on the same page. It's baffling to me.
Follow the money. You got it.
Yeah,
you got it.
Money. Remember the gun issues when Bloomberg was giving our Senate president all this money to campaign, you know, and we didn't get the good gun bills. We got gun control instead. Money. So where's the? So I don't know how you trace it, but there's got to be money going to the legislators. This is too predetermined. You know, the fact that they said they banned, you know, the health departments from mandating vaccines, but they allowed them to mandate treatments by any means necessary. So they didn't stop what they said they stopped. They lied, basically. Gene, go ahead.
I was going to say too, though, I give DeSantis a lot of credit because recently when he came out and he said, you know, they made mistakes when, you know, at first. And it takes a strong person to admit that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciate that. And, you know, right away, you may not do exactly what is right because, you know, people get, you know, fear takes over, whatever. But the thing is, as soon as you realize you're on the wrong path to backtrack or to change trajectory, that says a lot about the person. And so kudos to him and whoever, you know, kept at him to say, hey, no, what we're doing is not right, because otherwise you could still be, you know, we could all be worse because of it. Because I think him and some of the other governors that spoke out, or not even governors, but people that spoke out, you know, made things start to happen anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got Jonathan coming on in about 5 minutes. I want to play something kind of fun here, because I always like to – I think humor is one of the best ways to get your message across. And then I want to get your contact information, anything you want to give about any organization, group, or events happening. So this is my response to the mandates from last Christmas. But now that we have the mild Omicron variant, I think it just applies even more to this Christmas. So here it is. I'll be right back. Hello, everyone. It's that time of year again. So here is just a friendly little message from your Action Radio revolutionaries. In preparation for Christmas and New Year's, we have just a few ideas and suggestions to make your holiday complete. Granted, these are times of adversity brought about by bureaucrats and what we affectionately call the leftist lockdown orgasmic power trip. But don't let a completely illegal, martial law style abdication and removal of your constitutional rights get in the way of a decent glass of eggnog with friends. After all, 6 foot social distancing is a completely false concept for a virus that can linger in the air for hours in aerosol form, can be sneezed well over 200 feet, can travel through an entire 10-story building central air system in a couple of minutes, and goes through a mask like a mosquito through a chain link fence. So, no matter what you do, everyone is getting exposed sometime. Leaving the healthy people alone accomplishes this in about 10 weeks. So, this should have been done the end of May. Speaking of masks, besides being a violation of your Fourth Amendment rights against seizure of your person, in this case, your face, without due process, the state can't make you wear a mask. So, go home if you're sick, but if not, go free face, as all real Americans are doing, and enjoy the Christmas season. Apparently, there is the deplorable lack of New Year's resolutions this year. Well, I have one. To resist. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to restore and rejuvenate that inner rugged individual the left has tried so hard to put behind a mask and lockdown, and I'm going to resist. So, you find a creative way to resist, there's your revolution resolution. Remember, folks, those Twilight Zone episodes where people wore masks? They were supposed to make you think, not make you copy them. Family values should be emphasized this Christmas with the traditions that bind us together. Sit as close as you can at dinner. Remember those wet kisses from Grandma when you were a kid? Engage in spirited debates. Don't forget to use serving dishes where everyone sticks their own personal fork and spoon in, all in the interest of sharing. Remind everyone that closing churches violates the First Amendment. Closing businesses without criminal convictions violates our Fifth Amendment right to life, liberty, and property. And closing schools denies our kids their right to an education. So, you may want to point that out to your governors and mayors this festive season so they understand their transgressions and can repent. I would have suggested you go to New York this year, but quite frankly, they don't have the balls to celebrate New Year's. No, really, the ball isn't dropping. Maybe we should rename Times Square Tiananmen Square West. Remember that there are many great gifts you can share this Christmas, particularly AR-15s and AK-47s. Those tend to warm the heart. As we say at Action Radio, world peace through strength. Just remember that everything the government tells you is wrong. So if you want to avoid COVID, don't take the vaccine. Go to the beach instead. Get that sunshine and vitamin D. Stay away from home. Engage in commerce and business. Travel as much as you can. Work out at crowded gyms. Drive extensively, preferably with the windows open. Patronize businesses that are in open rebellion. And resist, resist, resist the doctor dictatorship. In closing, let me just say Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and Happy Hanukkah. Muslims, you don't have a holiday at this time, so just go eat Chinese food on Christmas Eve and meet some really nice Jewish folks. Hey, they might be your neighbors. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio. Who says we don't have fun here? So when you
I need that.
I, Well, exactly. And I made you line live again just because I heard you laughing. I thought, well, I got to get this on the recording too. So I had a little bit of fun with that. But yeah, so when you shared the show with everybody, say, you know, don't forget to listen to the entire hour that you were on because we have a little bit of a Christmas greeting. Well, you know, like, and I have more parodies on the way, but I made most of these during 2020 when, you know, the lockdowns happened. And the lockdown, you know, when I get angry, I get creative. So, you know,
they are awesome. I love it. I actually want to record that and play it for others to hear.
Well, I can send it to you. Well, now that I'm in a funny mood, I'm going to leave you live again. And Jonathan's not here yet, so let's have a little bit more fun. Let me play you my other favorite piece, the New Normal Church and Grocery Store. Another little parody. Here we go. Hello, America. Looks like millions of you are in states where the governor dictator has said that food is essential, but God is not. Fortunately, we have a solution for you. We've combined your essential food shopping with a non-essential religious experience. Being in the same building and being completely intertwined, you can't do one without the other. Welcome to the New Normal Church and Grocery Store. Yes, the New Normal Church and Grocery Store is the first business of its kind to bring God conveniently into your food shopping aisle. Think of this as food for your body and food for your soul. No social distance or group size restrictions here. Upon entering the New Normal Church and Grocery Store, you will pick up your shopping cart. You can then choose from an optional mask with a Star of David, a cross, a crescent moon, a sun for you Shintos, a statue of Buddha, and for you agnostics, a question mark. Headsets are available to play sermons throughout your shopping experience. Some of the favorites include, I'm going to heaven and you're not, Die, Infidel, Die, Oi, What Not to Say During the Bris, and That Butterfly May Be Your Grandfather. To orient you to the store, the Kosher Jewish Deli is by the Western Wall. A simple shalom gets you service, but be prepared to haggle. For you Muslims, out of courtesy, we put the halal butcher by the Eastern Wall. Sharia store policies require the wearing of both a burqa and a mask, just to be safe. Protestants will find the Wonder Bread, hot dogs, and steak in the central aisles, where all the best-dressed customers can also be found. When you notice the smell of incense, you are nearing the Buddhist section, which is all vegetarian. For Catholics, communion is available in the bakery department by the wafers near the red wine section. Agnostics should go directly to customer service because you folks have no idea what you want anyway. Be sure to offer your confessional to the checker on the way out if you so choose. Please don't forget to first pull down the blind on the plexiglass screen. And if you require ministering, you can talk to your bagger as they push your groceries to your car because all our baggers are cross-trained in theology. The New Normal Church and Grocery Store, your combination alternative to the separation of church by the state. There you go.
I'm going to have a whole new love for my bagger at Publix.
What, are they cross-trained in theology too?
Yes, they must be.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, that was one of my more fun ones. Actually, all this is on my Action Radio YouTube channel. And so I'll send you the channel. In fact, I'll post it on my Facebook page too, and I'll put it in the Action Radio group, which is public. Facebook page I have to make for friends because I'm sick of the trolls. And so far, having done that, I haven't been canceled yet. So I think I've removed the troll problem. Anyway, we've got Jonathan Mosley on the line. Cindy, do you have to go or do you want to stand for a while or what's up?
Well, I do have to go, but I want to plug again HB 687, free speech of healthcare practitioners bill. We're looking for Senator Broxson to sponsor that. So anybody that's willing and able to express their support for that and Senator Broxson to sponsor it, please reach out to his office and encourage him to do that. Sadly, it wouldn't take effect until next July, but I do believe that if that passed, we would have a lot of healthcare professionals speaking differently.
No, it makes perfect sense. In fact, if you need me to come with you or you want me to come visit any representatives, you know, feel free to just let me know. We can talk off the air. I want to do that. And I also want to meet with Jerry Williamson and a couple other folks. Our new website should be out today or tomorrow. And so I'll have nice, clear images of the bills, particularly those two that I wrote, the parental rights bill, which actually makes them rights and not, you know, as authorized by law, which defeats the purpose of having a right. And the second one on public health puts the public health department and all their declarations and emergencies clearly subordinate to our constitutional and individual rights. And so those are two I want to see if we can get those sponsored. And if not, then we need to contact with the governor's office or a senator, Broxson, and we'll see if he has the balls, as they say, to actually do the right thing here too. Last I heard, he was still, you know, running out from a public meeting, you know, and they caught him videotaping him dashing away into the distance, bravely running off into the sunset. Maybe I've already alienated him from talking to me, but okay. Anyway, so
we're going to pray that he does the right thing on this. So
it'd be nice.
We'll give him another opportunity to do differently.
Okay. So you got your contact information out? I think you already did that, right? Just to make sure.
Citizens for Medical Freedom, and the 4 is the number 4. You can find us on Telegram, Gab, Facebook. Our efforts on the sidewalk have kind of paused for right now with the injunctions and whatnot. We're kind of in the holiday season. We're kind of taking a break from that. But certainly we're gearing up for our regular session in January, which is going to mean we need to stay in contact with our legislators and let them know that, we're not letting up. I mean, while these injunctions are good, we still have the same people in place to enforce these unconstitutional mandates, and the discrimination has run rampant, and everybody seems to be okay with it. So we need to stay on them about addressing that in the regular session.
Yeah, that's another thing, too, when you talk about next time, too, is discrimination of health workers, like a two-tiered society at work. So that's a huge one, too.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Cindy. I appreciate you coming
You're
on this
welcome.
Week. Let's do it again next week, and I'm going to get to Jonathan Seam, and then we're going to talk about a bunch of legal issues. But, again, you're always welcome to stay or call back in, but if you have to go, then we'll
All
do
right.
it next week.
Thanks so much. Right. Thanks for the laugh.
Hey, listen, I'll send you the video. I'm going to post those videos because they're all on YouTube now. I found a website that converts, my MP3 soundtracks to YouTube. So you'll be able
Perfect.
To share them everywhere. Yeah, I'll do that after the show. All right.
Great. All right. Y'all have a good day.
All right. See you later, Cindy.
All right. Bye.
It probably started with an episode of Perry Mason many years ago, that yearning to understand the law so that you can help people who don't understand the law. The arguments, the debates, the mental trial beyond the actual trial, all the while trying to do the best you can for your client. He walks the halls of justice, pictures on the wall of great minds who advance the law. He walks not in the black robes of the judge, but the suit and tie of the attorney. Known as counselor, lawyer, or any number of other names, and after years of hard work, these are the people accepted to the bar and allowed to practice law, especially at trial. For it is at trial, many times, that the great decisions of our society are realized. It's where the laws get tested. It's where juries have lost their power to judge the laws and not just the facts. It's where judges make up their own law, especially through interpretations. But if you are ever in trouble, your attorney can be your best friend. We are privileged at Action Radio to have one of those practitioners of the law. Someone who knows the Constitution, who knows about due process, who takes the rights of the individual as sacred, and will fight for them with all he's got. It is at this time every week that we immerse ourselves in the law. So join us in the law as we go to the Action Radio Legal Report with Jonathan Mosley. You know, so interesting. We missed 1 week with Thanksgiving, and then we had just so much to catch up on because there is more things happening on the legal front, especially with an illegal insurrection currently occupying the White House, passing illegal mandates onto us that we have to challenge in court legally. It's just where should we start? Jonathan, good to have you back on the show. Hope your Thanksgiving was well.
Hi. Great to be here. I have no idea where to start, but we're taking, like the game show wheel, turning the wheel and just picking it.
I'd like to go with Steve Bannon, if that's okay, because I know you've wanted to talk about this for a couple of weeks, and we haven't, I haven't heard from much yet, and especially now they're trying to indict Roger Stone again. It's like the political prisoner committee, of Nancy Pelosi's, in Congress, like the Star Chamber, that they are, trying to bring about this, to cover up their insurrection. This is fascinating.
No,
So, if you want to go with that, then we got, all the other things. We got the rest of the show to chat. So take your time, feel free. We got lots to going. If you have to leave early, that's okay. But if you want to stick around, I mean, you're certainly welcome to, because we have many things to discuss. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I like, warrior. I mean, it is like, I don't know, that I can't think of the right, I'm getting my morning coffee because,
okay.
Well, you're even earlier there, but the, you know, it's like a special bonus edition or something, because whatever the terminology they use in TV.
Yeah.
But the, and of course, you know, I'm not sure quite how to say it, but when we talk about legal things on the Action Radio, it's really the intersection of government, politics, and law. It's not just, you know, should you get a will. It's the it's how legal it, you know, how legal issues are being played out in the leadership of our country and the politics. What some people call lawfare, which is the warfare by law. It originated a lot with the infiltration and insurrection and takeover from the way Muslim jihad does it, which exists whether everybody's part of it or not. There are those who are. And now it's become a general term, I think, that applies to political in general. It's the, you know, the use of the law to attain political advantage or political goals. And so we're not just here talking about, you know, what do you do about your DWI? But there's so much going on, and it's incredible. And, you know, I'm, you know, the select committee to investigate the January 6th, it's such a long title, I'm not even going to try to get it right. The select committee to investigate the January 6th, events is a star chamber. It is atrocious. It is one of the centers of what's going on in our country that is deeply, deeply troubling. It's not only there; it's also happening in the Department of Justice. But it is one of the centers of insurrection in our country. Now, the thing is that they are pulling people in there to testify.
Mm-hmm.
One flaw, I mean, I'm praying, dear God, let me defend. So there's one lawyer who I'm working with on other things, on the defending the January 6th defendants, who may be called in, and I would just love to represent her in the committee. I mean, they probably throw me in the hooscow overnight but it is, the more I think about it, it is a star chamber. It is the most atrocious abuse of politics and government and law. Yeah,
where are the
in
gildings?
Our country's history.
Where's the gilding old party objecting to this? I mean, I don't see them every day. You know, there's no daily press conference. There's no daily, here's where they screwed up this time. There's no daily, you know, this is how they're a tyrannical, you know, a cover-up of the insurrection, you know, it's a political prisoner committee, that's all it is. You know, where's the opposition to it? Where are the geldings?
One of them is sitting on the committee, or two of them actually, are sitting on the committee participating in the insurrection against the United States by the U.S. Constitution, by the Congress. And of course, what's encouraging that this hope is that so much of this is obvious to the American mm-hmm. people, and they, for once in like decades, they don't need to have it explained, but I'll explain in more detail because, first of all, this, you know, Steve Bannon says he's going to make this the misdemeanor from hell, and there's a lot of discussion about who else may appear. Ali Alexander, who I'd never heard of, but he created this company called Stop the Steal.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the people who were involved in January 6th, he's the only person who admits to being an organizer. Everybody else, you know, like my client Zach, who Real, the president of the Proud Boys chapter,
uh-huh.
We had on his vice president Aaron Wilkind, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah,
and you know
that was a great interview,
like,
by the way. That was fabulous. I, you know, definitely want to get him back, you know, next week again or soon. Yeah, he was amazing. Yeah,
everybody should share it and share your podcast of it,
uh-huh.
And other ones of course too, and. I've shared it with some people. So the thing is that they're treating him like Napoleon Bonaparte on the Elba Island. Is that the island? You know, if they let him
Able
off the island,
I, there I saw Elba. You know, it's the great palindrome of all time. Yeah, that's he ended up exiled to Elba Island. Yeah, if I remember my palindromes.
So the thing is that as I say, the theme is that everybody is the leader.
Mm-hmm.
There's everybody who's there is nobody who's not a leader. And so if
they
let him out on bail, he will. I don't know. But the thing is, the only person who actually, before January 6th, called himself the leader
mm-hmm.
is Ali Alexander, whom, and he gave
him was he leader of?
This
wasn't
he
an
said he's the national organizer of, he said he's
of
the national organizer of Stop the Steal. I know what you're correct. Like, they're being intentionally misleading and vague about what it is.
Oh, that's like Unite the Right. Remember Charlottesville,
right.
The Unite the Right? This leftist group proclaiming themselves actually the alt-right, which doesn't exist except in the leftists who want to demonize the right, as a fake group.
Right.
And
it's
another fake group or what?
Well, I mean, yes, but the thing is, like I've said before, I think people, to follow along, to get
mm-hmm.
their program, their legend or whatever, it's important to recognize. I live in Virginia. I saw the advertisements leading up to Charlottesville, for example, on Facebook and everything like that. And there's all these different groups. People need to understand how, the people who are getting newly involved, there is a lot to learn. I mean, yes, you're citizens, and yes, you have a right to speak up, and no, you should not conform, and no, you should not let training, squash you into somebody's box. But there is a lot to learn. And what I've seen a lot I've been doing politics since 1984, and
oh,
we have
that
all these different groups.
That's an interesting year to get started.
Yeah, I know, it was kind of ironic. I noticed at the time before Charlottesville happened, they had all these different groups promoting it, and when you have a big event, different organizations try to activate their list, their
mm-hmm.
people, and they try to take oversized credit for it. So they will call it, not always, but they'll often call it something different. So you have the Unite the Right in Charlottesville probably had like 20 different names, and not everybody activating their group to come to Charlottesville had the same goals.
Huh.
Some came because they just care about history. Some came because they're just pissed off at liberals and want to, whatever they say, they want to do the opposite. There are people there who, maybe had bad goals. But, to say that the Unite the Right was the name of the Charlottesville demonstrations, it is not really the whole picture. And the same is true of January 6th. And November, what was it? November, forget the date, but and December. Remember, they had the Million Mega March in November, and we talked a lot with Aaron Wilkind about December 12th.
Yeah, like November 15th, December 12th. They were just tired of rallies, and this was like their third one. It's like, oh, we got to go to this one. They didn't want to be.
Right.
They didn't want
to
have the chief of people beating up people. Yeah.
Yeah, no. It was the people need to hear that, to hear what people being knifed by Antifa
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that, and that's okay because and what really bothers is like the idea that they're called Antifa. Oh my God, you're really fooled by what they call themselves? I mean, are you kidding? I mean, they say we're anti-fascist.
Yeah, well, that's because they're
communists. Yeah, and I'm Ethel Merman,
back to just jump in here for a second, but the anti-fascists, the anti-fascisti go back, they were the communists. So Germany, people forget that Germany was not the left versus the right. Nazi Germany was the left versus the left. And you had the leftist communists who called themselves anti-fascists, and you had the Nazis who were called the fascists. So you had the communists versus the fascists. And the question is, which leftist group was going to win? Well, the fascists won. The Nazis won. Kicked the butt of the communists. And so you had a leftist victory over another leftist. And people don't understand that Charlottesville is basically the same thing. You had leftist groups one calling themselves Unite the Right, and another calling themselves whatever else they were calling themselves. But you basically had left-on-left violence as to who was the biggest, baddest leftist group. And, you know, people don't they never think that, because you're always told that the fascists are right-wing, which, of course, is nonsense. And I've proven that over and over again, even to Bert the Nazi, who calls in periodically. You know, so the misconceptions of this, of January 6th, but that's the propaganda. That's the goal. You have to put lies in people's heads so they don't really know what happened. And they can't, because if they knew what happened, then it would be entirely different perspective. And we would see that the D.C. gulag is a home of political prisoners, a place where American citizens are tortured. You know, and someday I'm hoping that those guards and the warden are brought to justice for the crimes they're committing of torture, of solitary confinement, of everything else they're doing. Yeah, go ahead, Jonathan. Yeah.
And I think part of the contributing factor is the lies these people are racist. So, that, you know, D.C. prison guards are, you know, how well are they going to treat prisoners whom they are told are all neo-Nazis and...
Oh, wait a minute. Are there black D.C. prison guards beating up white Trump supporters in a racist, hate-filled attack? I'm just curious. Just asking the question.
Well, of course, but you know, one could say that responsible people in government, you know, telling them that these guys are all racist, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and clones of, you know, the boys from Brazil, clones of Adolf Hitler, you know, because we live in this age where nobody's responsible for violence. They're inspired, which is like, you know, so if, you know, if everybody says that the prisoners are racist and white supremacists, which they're clearly not, does that
justify
anything?
Well, even if they were,
no.
you still can't torture them. These people have not been convicted
of anything.
And even if they were convicted, you still can't torture them. We have a provision in the Constitution against cruel and unusual punishment, which includes solitary confinement for people who haven't been convicted of anything. People are being held simply on trumped up, excuse the expression, evidence, you know, that's all made up. This is a political prisoner this is a gulag. You know, it's a DC gulag. And so the basic constitutional provisions are being violated. Why is this DC jail even still in operation? I don't even understand that. That thing should be closed down. And where are the geldings calling for it to be closed down?
That's true. So,
and move these people to a federal prison where put them in a country club. Until their trial.
I mean, there is probably those that are the country clubs that are closed down, everything with the economy. But the thing is that the law recognizes something called an intervening superseding cause.
Okay.
So like if I do some, if there's some, you know, multi-level marketing thing, and I organize people to go door to door trying to sign people up, and then someone on their own commits a crime, there's a break in the chain of causation that's well recognized in the law. But of course, we've thrown the law, you know,
so what's that called
overboard.
Again? That sounds like
an intervening. It could be called if it's an intervening, superseding criminal act.
Okay.
So if I have employees and then somebody commits a crime, they'll say, well, they committed that's a break between my involvement and them deciding to commit a crime that has nothing to do with me. And, you know, so what we're talking about is well established in the law, but the law is being ignored.
Well, that's like the murderer at Charlottesville who ran over the woman in the car. You know, that doesn't mean that everybody there was a conspiracy murderer trying to kill everybody who was opposed to them. It just means that person committed a murderous act, right?
Right, but that's the way the left thinks, or rather they feel. And there's considerable evidence that he panicked. He was being beaten on by, his car was being beaten on by people illegally in the street.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, for example, under Virginia, now this is, you know, all of this is eroding quickly, but in Virginia law, if I say, well, I'm going to sue you for negligence because you hit me with your car, and traditionally we say, yeah, but you were, you know, walking in the middle of I-95. So under the law in Virginia, that would be contributory negligence or, what's the other word? So you could say, yes, you're guilty, but we're going to block it because you're guilty too. You know, in some states they would say it's a percentage. In some places it would be an absolute denial. It's like, yes, my client hit to do with his car, but you were standing in the middle of I-95, so no, you don't get to sue. Mm-hmm. And that would be the way the law would traditionally deal with it. But anyway, so let's go to Steve Bannon. So here's the thing. First of all, executive privilege, driving me crazy. Gelding in the gelding old party or whatever you want to call them.
Hey, you're using it too. Isn't this cool? You can call them Dr. Fascist too. I mean, you get all my key buzzwords, my talking points. I like it.
Well, Chris Plant, radio talk show host here in D.C., has been saying for years that if the left didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all.
Yeah,
and now
that's
it's
a good
caught
line.
On. And
yeah.
Yeah, if you have a good idea, people will steal it and they won't remember where it came from.
No, I don't care.
But,
why don't they use it?
Sadly. but anyway, Steve Bannon, the thing is, it's driving me crazy, is that people here in Washington, D.C., they don't know anything about the Constitution. An expert in Washington, D.C. is someone who has learned the conventional wisdom talking points and can blurt back the talking points, but doesn't actually know anything. Only in a memorizing talking points, not in actually knowing anything about the substance. Nobody knows a fig about executive privilege and all this other stuff. So Steve Bannon, and of course we lie about the facts. Steve Bannon, I've seen two of the letters. There are probably more. He was subpoenaed to appear before the Star Chamber, which is the insurrection. His lawyer sent a letter back saying Donald Trump has invoked executive privilege. He's filed a lawsuit, so we're going to wait. Now, under the law, it is absolutely 1,000% impossible to be in contempt. If you say, yes, I'll come, I'm just going to wait to see what the courts instruct me to do. So there is no possibility of being in contempt when you say yes. But I can't because the courts are working on it, and then we'll see what the courts have to say, and then I will comply. So
you cannot
be in
contempt of Congress,
when you
right?
say yes, I'll comply.
When you say contempt, you mean contempt of Congress, contempt of this committee? That's
correct.
Because he was subpoenaed.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Not contempt of court.
Well, I mean, legally
contempt.
We all have contempt for Congress, but legally contempt of Congress. So the thing is, and now everybody will lie about it, and they say, well, you still have, they'll say things like, you still have to show up. No, you don't. If you say, because normally you negotiate, you know, if they subpoena you for next Tuesday, and your lawyer writes back and says, I'm attending my mother's funeral next Tuesday, let's do it on a different date. That happens all the time. That's not contempt.
Yeah.
So, no, you don't have to show up. If your lawyer says, well, let's wait until the courts have decided this issue and then we'll schedule it at that time. Completely normal. And it's not, you know, you cannot be in contempt for saying yes.
makes sense.
But that's the situation. So then they want to say, well, we don't think in various arguments that Donald Trump's claim of executive privilege doesn't matter. If I'm the witness and the former president says, don't testify, I've got this claim going on, it doesn't matter to the witness if it's right or wrong. It's not his role to decide whether or not the executive privilege claim is valid. That's for the courts. So I am showing respect for the courts. And if the courts end up saying, no, you should testify, fine, you know, I'll be there.
This is material that Steve Bannon is going to be required to testify on based on his work with President Trump, right? This isn't just Steve Bannon on his own. This is what the executive – we should explain executive privilege too. But this is what they're talking about. They want to know specific conversations with President Trump, you know, during the time that Steve Bannon was serving in the Trump administration. That's what they're talking about, right?
That and also they're claiming that – That after he was no longer working for the administration, that he helped plan again, you know,
the
black box, murky. Yeah, he planned something.
He doesn't have to
identify what it is.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, this is where everything has a different name.
make it up as we go along. Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So what's executive privilege?
So the thing is
yeah, go ahead.
So let's go back to executive privilege. I first researched this in the 1990s at Judicial Watch. Mm-hmm. And executive privilege is, I mean, I want to tear what little hair I have out, because nobody in Washington knows a clue about, they don't even bother. I mean,
well, they just hear privilege. They hear the word privilege and they react to it because it's like white privilege. It's like whatever privilege is. Well, if you have privilege, you must be special.
Know.
If you're special, you're not equal to me. And so therefore, you know, that's they hear executive privilege. They don't hear executive. So they don't understand the connection to what it really is. That's why I'm asking. That's why I want to go over it. Yeah.
Right. Executive privilege goes back to George Washington, literally. Mm-hmm. The first invocation of executive privilege, though they didn't think up that name yet, was literally in the presidential administration of George Washington. Congress asked for information about the negotiation of a treaty, which I should remember what it was, and he said, no, I'm not giving you that. And part of it is rooted in the fact that there are three co-equal branches,
mm-hmm.
and each of them has to be able to function and not, you know, sabotage the other. And the so the ability of the executive branch to function as a co-equal branch, not the slave of the Congress,
mm-hmm.
is one of the reasons for it, and it has been well accepted over and over and over again. Now, when Nixon came along, they made a mess of it, and
he was trying to hide his crimes under executive privilege. You know, that's the problem,
right.
Nixon. And but it's interesting, it's the Republicans that went after Nixon, Howard Baker. I don't know, Sam
right.
Irvin, the lawyer, I think he was Republican too. This is back when Republicans actually, you know, they put, you know, country and principle over politics, whereas the Democrats would never do that. You know, if we had an equivalent, well, we had
right.
an equivalent situation. We've got an insurrection going on now
but that's
by the Democrats. They'd never prosecute that in a hearing. Never. Anyway, go ahead.
Right, but that's where they're wrong, because you can't just be one way. But so
right.
the thing is that executive privilege, and it's very clear,
mm-hmm.
it exists to protect future presidents.
Hmm.
Can a former
okay.
president invoke executive privilege? Hell yes, because it's not about him. It's not about the current president. It's about the ability of the institution to be able
okay.
to function.
That's interesting.
And the core of executive privilege, like the lesser deliberative process privilege, is that a president needs to be able to get candid advice. And that explicitly, although I'm using modern terminology, means, you know, off-the-wall advice. If he's got 10 people sitting around the room, or he talks to 10 people separately, and, you know, someone gives them, like, you know, you should invade Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. The ability to get candid, free-willing, brainstorming, discussion, advice is that we have considered essential to the president to be able to function. And people won't give him advice or ideas or suggestion or talking, you know, just kick things around if they're afraid it's going to end up in, you know, in whatever
the public.
The Washington Star way back when it started, you know, and they're going to censor themselves, and they won't give the president advice, and he won't be able to get advice, and he won't be able to do his job. And so the idea that, well, Steve Bannon was not a government employee, completely ridiculous. You know, it doesn't matter if the president, you know, if the president wants to go and get advice from, I don't know why I have the head of Microsoft. I don't know why I have a mental block for his.
Bill Gates.
If he wants to go, yeah, Bill Gates. If he wants to go and say, tell me about the cyber threat to the country,
mm-hmm.
he has a right to get advice. Doesn't matter if the person is a private citizen or a government official. It's about the presidency getting advice. So he could convene, like, you know, 10 farmers in Iowa,
mm-hmm.
and sit around the kitchen table and ask them for advice on agricultural policy. They don't have to be government employees. It's ridiculous. I mean, that people saying that, they're so unbelievably ignorant.
They're reinforcing the bubble. They only believe people who think like them.
Exactly.
It's like if you only believe people
perfectly
in your country
said.
Club. you know, that's the bubble. So they reinforce their own, you know, propaganda, which leads to something I wanted to say earlier. Assumptions are stronger than truth, and that they reinforce their incorrect assumptions. Actually, I talked about that with Cindy in the previous report, that assumptions, their assumptions that they're right, and their arrogance that they're right precludes any criticism of themselves, and therefore anything they do must be right because they're right. You know, it's a reinforcing of an assumption that they've got a base, their fundamental base of assumption is wrong, but they're using that wrong assumption to convince themselves that they're actually right no matter what they do, even when they're wrong. So it's a self-correcting, self-prophecy. It's fascinating how the mental gyration of these people think. But I think with executive privilege, I would actually rename it executive prerogative, executive procedure, you know, executive protection, you know, or something, well, or procedures protection or something. But the whole idea of privilege, because privilege has become such a demonized word that I don't think that Trump and Bannon are really realizing that it's the perception of the word privilege that is their biggest enemy right now because of white privilege.
That's interesting.
You know, and I don't think they've thought of this. You know, this whole different angle. Well, this is what we talk about this stuff on the show. We brainstorm. But there was a diplomat. I don't know if – go ahead. And I got another point for you. Yeah, go ahead.
All those things are beautifully said. Some of the best, you know, explanations I've seen about the bubble and things like that. But but you also have to understand that,
mm-hmm.
you know, like attorney-client privilege, it does not mean – and I think why people want to attack and tear it down is that they think that it means immunity. And, you know, for example, if Nixon was committing a crime,
right.
you cannot, and of course we're wrong on this. I mean, they're inconsistent with their own line of precedence in the Nixon case. Because if you have evidence outside of a presidential communication,
mm-hmm.
then he's not immune. But if you can't prove it without invading the private conversations, A, you don't have a case. Your case is pretty weak. And B, you can't use the private conversations to prove the crime. And they think, well, maybe in private conversations, President Trump planned with or instructed people to do something outside of the private conversation. Well, then mm-hmm. you'd have evidence outside of the private conversation. You know,
yeah.
if they privately mapped it all out on the Resolute desk in the Oval Office,
mm-hmm.
then if it never left that room, then it would be privileged. But if there was any kind of thing to be concerned about, there would have to be communication outside of the Oval Office to implement it. So if you don't have any evidence other than the private conversation, you got nothing. Go home. You know, close up your briefcase and go to lunch. Because the thing is, executive privilege, like attorney-client privilege and other things, says that it does not mean like let's say I go and I spend 6 hours talking with President DeSantis.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, you know, I get smashed drinking whiskey. And then I go outside and I get a DWI. Well, I'm not immunized from the DWI because I was talking to the president. But nothing in the conversation could be used or invaded. You know, it doesn't mean, and people say, well, what if in the conversation he's committing crime? But he can't. There is no possibility of the private conversation committing a crime because it would have to have external implementation. And I hope I'm making sense.
Well, yeah, and even if you advocate in a private conversation, it's still not a crime to advocate. It's only a crime to do it. You know, so you can talk about, you know, I'm sure that when the plumbers, you know, bugged the Watergate Hotel, you know, I'm sure they talked about it in advance. Well, they hadn't committed a crime yet. They're just talking about it, even though it's an illegal act, you know, because people talk about things all the time. Gee, it'd be fun to rob that bank. Okay, I just talked about a crime. Am I going to do it? No. So you can't prosecute me for the fact that I said, gee, it might be fun to rob a bank. Okay, that's just a stupid statement. You know, so the difference between the statement and the action is what distinguishes, you know, prior restraint, where where they arrest you in communist countries for what you think they think you might do, and a free society where you're only arrested for actually what you do. So the private conversation is really irrelevant unless it was in conspiracy of an actual crime that was done. But you got to start with the crime. And I'll get onto the whole premise of the January 6th in a minute. But does that make sense?
I mean,
am I on the right track here?
Right. Well, we do need to get to that. To what is that's part another part of this whole thing. But But the thing is that there are, you know, there are things that could be like conspiracies or things like that. But basically, if you need, like I said, if you need the private conversation of the president, you don't have a case.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. So the idea that like, oh, we need to be able to, you know, and the other, to do this, then it's like, well, if you don't have enough evidence before you try to lift executive privilege, then you give up because you don't got anything.
That's the basis of search warrants. You have to know what you're searching for. You can't have like random fishing expeditions, which is what this really is.
Exactly.
They have probable
cause.
Yeah. They're hoping to find the evidence to justify the crime that they want to convict on. So it's basically just judicial wishful thinking is what they're really doing. Right.
Yes. Because if you think about that, what they're arguing, which drives me crazy, means that there would never be a time when you couldn't say, well, I'd just like to find out if there's a crime. So basically, the privilege doesn't exist. And it means that the executive branch has now become powerless and the slave of the legislative branch, which has always been a struggle. But
we all have
our founders.
Yeah. We've all become their slave.
That's it. Yeah. But the thing is that they try to make them co-equal. And it's always been a struggle to make sure that, you know, Congress doesn't slit the throat of the executive branch. So, but what you're, you know, if you didn't have probable cause before the search warrant, it makes you say, well, let's just pick some random house and search them because maybe we'll find a crime there. Or the attorney-client privilege, for example. If it is not privileged if someone is planning to commit, well, it's complicated. If someone says, well, you know, what can I do that's legal and not legal? And someone says, oh, you're planning to commit a crime. No, I'm trying to avoid committing a crime by knowing the where the lines are. If an attorney and a client are planning to commit a crime, a future crime, then the privilege doesn't apply. So that means, let's invade every attorney-client privilege with every attorney and every client, because who knows, maybe, you know, somewhere in there they plan some crime of some kind.
That's backwards. So that's the old, if you have nothing to hide, you know, you shouldn't worry about being investigated. I said, well, that's not the point. The point is that there are enough laws that anybody can be convicted on anything. You know, that the government has to prove that they have something to prove. You know, it's not that I have to prove I have nothing to hide. I don't have to prove I have nothing to hide. I have the presumption of innocence, you know, and everybody has a presumption of innocence. And that's the whole point of the presumption of innocence, is to put the burden on the government to prove, you know, their case first. You know, that's why law enforcement is tougher in a free society. It's supposed to be tougher. You know, that's why investigations are tougher in a free society. They're supposed to be, because you can't go willy-nilly in fishing expeditions. Right. You can't round up 50 people, question them for what you think might have happened maybe. Okay? It's supposed to be tougher. That's what makes a society free, is that it's tougher to just, you know, you have to have an accusation. You have to have evidence. You have to build a case. You have to have probable cause. Well, half the Bill of Rights is devoted to the rights of the accused. Why? So that the innocent people don't go to jail. The whole purpose of the Bill of Rights, most of it, it seems to me, is to protecting the innocent so the innocent don't go to jail. That's why I've always been against capital punishment, but that's another argument. But, you know, this whole idea. One last point here. The whole point of the January 6th committee, we should really state what they are. They are a committee to cover up their crimes. They've established a government committee to put the blame on somebody else for something that they did. So the inherent, the basis, the bias, the whole assumption that that committee is operating under is false, because they are an illegal commission acting to cover up an illegal crime by proving something against innocent people. That's what's really going on here, and that needs to be stated clearly.
I'm uncomfortable, about the argument that, you know, because you didn't lock your jewelry store or your guard went on break, therefore it's okay to rob the jewelry store. But it's very clear, on the other hand, that what happened on January 6th is a massive series of mistakes by Nancy Pelosi and the Sergeant at Arms of the thing.
Were they mistakes?
You know, those
I don't think there were mistakes. What? The purpose of letting people in was to cover up the fact that they were stopping the count of the electors. That was the insurrection. And
well,
then
I
had the vote afterwards.
But we don't have, but we have to take it in stages because you know while that may be true, you know because they have a select committee to investigate what happened on January 6th. And they almost, you say it word for word like that. Problem is that what they think happened on January 6th is that people held political beliefs that the establishment doesn't agree with. So they say that, well, Donald Trump spread misinformation about the election. You can spread misinformation. You know, if you want to go out and say that, what was that, Mystery Planet, Nuru or something like that. You know, if you want to go on saying things and you say, well, I think you're absolutely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's still protected by the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that
the
committee says and the news media says that that what Trump was saying about the election is not true.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to interfere with that. It's guaranteed by the First Amendment. And there, you know, like I said, there is evidence, but we haven't pinned it down that in getting plea deals, if the January 6th, the prosecution is asking them to, you know, to declare that the election was perfect and Joe Biden is your president, condition of getting a plea deal, blatantly unconstitutional.
Yeah.
It's coerced speech. And so what they're not doing with the January 6th Select Committee in the House is investigating what happened on January 6th. They're persecuting people for their political beliefs, which is in fact a civil rights crime.
Can they be prosecuted for that? For misuse of government authority?
If there were any honest prosecutors left, yes, hell yes. They are
Would that be the Justice Department or would that be a state? A state bring a suit against this committee for that to protect their state representatives or their state citizens?
It could be either. There's this myth that only federal courts can hear federal crimes, which is not true.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
But everybody believes it, even though it's not true.
Assumptions. Assumptions is more than truth.
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing is that they are persecuting people. For example, if one person, you know, I sent suggestions to Ali Alexander's email. He went out there and he said, well, I'm going to show up because I can't afford the legal fees to fight the subpoena. And I asked the guy who's doing it. He says, nah, he's just punking them. He says, we're fine. We got it handled. But I sent him some suggestions, like what I would like to do is they say, now, can you tell me everyone who talked about the insurrection? It's like, Congressman, I don't know anything about any insurrection. You know, now, when did you first talk about, you know, hear about the riots? Like, Congressman, I'm sorry, I don't know anything about any riots. Because
I was just walking through the Capitol, man. I was taking selfies. You know, hey, what are you guys talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. So because the thing is that they are unable. They are so emotionally damaged, sick people that they can't. They will never be able to recognize. I see what you. I mean, a good person says, I see what you're doing. So I'll just rephrase the question. They can't. They're incapable of rephrasing the question. But the other thing is that, you know, what I would do is say, okay, my client is not going to answer opinions. You are not here to ask his or her political opinions. You are here to ask what happened on January 6th. Those are, you know, so if they're facts and if they are facts about what happened on January 6th, I'll answer them. If you're asking me for my political beliefs, we're going to have, you know, here's your lawsuit.
Yeah, and, that makes sense. Well, is this something Steve Bannon could do? You know, and I would question, you know, I would, if I were Steve Bannon before, and I'd love to go before Congress in this, I'd say, well, where were you January 6th? What were you doing? Did you get the talk? Were you instructed to vote against the electors? What happened there? Let's talk about the real insurrection. You people. You know, I mean, it'd be fascinating. They'd probably shut me down immediately. But those are the questions that need to be asked. What the Gelding should do is hold a separate January 6th hearing about what the people that voted against the Brandon insurrection, the 12 senators and the 140 House members that actually voted that the electors that we need to continue with that, and they voted against the approving. Those are the folks that need to hold a separate, you know, commission and say let's investigate the investigators. That's what they should do, but they're gelding, so they won't. That's the problem.
Well, because that's the thing is that led by Dick Cheney, joked about as George Bush's brain. We were supposed to build, nation build in Iraq, and instead we're nation building. We needed to be nation building here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So Liz Cheney is trying to treat the U.S. the United States people like Iraq, like her father did. I mean, mm-hmm. we are trampling the rights, the constitutional rights and the freedoms of the American people, the way her father, you know, wanted to reshape Iraq. And, if I were in the room, I'd tell that to her face. It's like, you are the enemies of the United States, foreign and domestic.
Yep.
The House Un-American Activities Committee, now known as a select committee.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, McCarthy was right, although he was, universally condemned. But this is the leftist version of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yeah, this is the censorship. This is everything they rail against. This is, this is the blacklisting. This is the persecution for political beliefs. This is everything that, that we should be against. And like I say, I'm hoping there's some massive lawsuits when these people finally do get out of that gulag. I want to take a break for a minute. I want to see if we want to change issues. Right. We've been on this one for a while. Give me a chance to get a cup of coffee. I'm going to play a little bit of our things. I'll play my Santa Rosa Volunteers piece on the Declaration of Independence. I have something from Eric Colley, our new webmaster. And so we'll be back in a few minutes. I'm going to mute your line for a bit so you can make noise and, clink glasses and do all that kind of stuff. And I want to get Gene back in the conversation. We've been going for over 45 minutes here, which is great. This is wonderful. I love this chat. It's good to have you back. So let me just take a quick break here for a bit, play some things, and then we'll pick up with Jonathan again on more issues. This is Greg Penglis with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. For our first founding lesson, I want to start with the Declaration of Independence. Basic to any understanding of freedom and liberty are these words written by Thomas Jefferson. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You will notice there is no reference to race, color, age, nationality, ethnic group, religion, or any of the common leftist categories they use to divide us. David Azarad, in his article for the Heritage Foundation, titled What the Constitution Really Says About Race and Slavery, December 28, 2015, says that no such concepts as race exist in the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, or any founding document. Therefore, since our founding documents have no such concept as race, it's kind of stupid of the left to say that we are founded on racism. The truth, folks, is that they simply made it up to suit their agenda of national sabotage and destruction, so that you would learn to hate your country. We hold these truths to be self-evident. No case need be made. It's plainly obvious. All men, meaning all people, are created equal. Granted, your status once you've come into the world is different from everyone else's because we all have different backgrounds, families, cultures, wealth, education, etc. We have differences, vast differences, but we are created equal. The whole concept of liberty, freedom, and rights are all dependent on keeping God above government. When governments believe they are gods, they will dispense rights as they see fit. When people believe they are gods, they will feel entitled to everything you have. True freedom comes only from the understanding and maintenance in government through control by the people that our rights are unalienable, that they cannot be separated from us, ever, because they came from a power higher than government, that we the people, also being a higher power, realize and maintain control over government because all just powers of government come from the consent of the governed. How we give our consent is why I created
Action Radio. I'll be back next week with another edition of Founding Moments, sponsored by the Santa Rosa Volunteers. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can increase foot and website traffic. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com, besmallbusiness. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it. This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. Action Radio, dedicated to fixing everything. All right, we're back here. We've got Jonathan Mosley in our legal report. We've got Gene Vernig, our producer, and me. your what was Rush Limbaugh say? Your friendly, lovable little fuzzball host, Greg Penglis. So, yeah, we've been and Jonathan, if you're ever on hold again, usually I have a couple of themes. I'll do my dedicated to fixing everything or our dangerously cool one. Either one of those usually gets us back into the show. Did you want to continue January 6th? Or I kind of like to move to what's happening in the Supreme Court on the Mississippi abortion case, because I think it's fascinating. I've been listening to the oral arguments. I've got the first half with the Mississippi, Attorney General, and then this rather contemptuous person from the federal government, you know, trying to justify Roe v. Wade, which is, you know, impossible to justify in any legal business because the Supreme Court has no authority to do anything with this, which I find fascinating too. Let me get your take on that, because that's kind of our title of the show. You know, Roe v. Wade was never a legal decision nor legal national policy. So if you want to have it that
way,
unfortunately,
better, I have not been following the details of this case, but I, of course, I know a lot about the background because, as you know, the Roe versus Wade was the Supreme Court wading into a political issue. They should have just left to the political process. They thought they were going to solve something, and they solved nothing. But it is one of the most atrociously written Supreme Court opinions. Court opinions, especially U.S. Supreme Court opinions, have a format. There's a structure to them, or at least there should be, you know, where they identify what the issues are, they identify what one side says, they identify what the other side says, and then they do a survey of the law all over the place, and then they analyze it, and then they're supposed to come to a conclusion. So it's a long opinion. It's hard to read, but if you really read it multiple times, as I have, it comes down to the legal argument that we don't know when life exists. I mean, it pretty much, although it's obscured in all kinds of references to various, you know, the back to Roman times and all kinds of things, and what it means. it's almost explicitly clear if you read it enough. But their argument is like we do not know. So they made this massive decision based on we don't know, leaving wide open the door. Like, well, what if at some point in the future we do know? Which, with science and ultrasound and all the developments of science since the 1970s, we do know. So Roe versus Wade is critically based upon ignorance, and overtaken by events in the last 50 years in medical advances. So that's why it's one of the most badly written opinions, because the idea it would be that if you don't know, why would you make this massive change? It's based on law review articles instead of actual law and things like that. And of course, it's also based upon, emanations and, shadows and penumbras from the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. I'll talk about that too. Yeah.
And it's based also on Griswold versus Connecticut, where they just made up this zone of privacy. Now, the zone of privacy in Griswold versus Connecticut, which overturned laws against birth control, sounds like a good idea. It sounds like there should have been more. There should have been more about that when our founders wrote the Constitution. It sounds like something. I don't know. There's some things in movies and things like that. Things that people believe a movie character said and they actually didn't. It sounds like something that Constitution, but it isn't.
Humphrey Bogart never said play
right,
it against
right,
Sam.
Right, right, yes.
There's a perfect example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the thing is that because they're just making it up fuzzy, it lacks any precision. And so that was the basis then of Roe versus Wade, completely ignoring, and this is where they said we don't know, because they were confronted with the idea, the fact that it's not just one person, it's two, and that's where they said that because we don't know, we're just to ignore the baby. And therefore, there's a zone of privacy by Griswold versus Connecticut, which isn't in the Constitution, and therefore we're going to do it. So it's always left itself open to, to being reconsidered on its own terms, what it says. But then it's been reaffirmed again and again and again. And Roe versus Wade is what many people call a super right, which is in any other right, there would be a reasonable balance. But you're just not allowed to touch the issue in our courts. Like, for example, the idea that, if I go to my dentist needs to have a relationship with a doctor in case there's an emergency. They have to be clean. They have to be hygienic. They have to, they have reasonable medical care, but not with abortion. I mean, I did I think it was a law review article, in fact, when I was in college at George Mason about some of the precedents.
Publish it. Let's read it. I'd love to read what you wrote in college. That'd be great.
I don't know if I still have it, but I, with different computers, I have to go back. But you talked about for some abortion clinics, the absolutely filthy conditions and, medically dangerous conditions, and they retaliated because abortion is a super right. And even though on its own terms, it's like shaky, but they've kind of hysterically gone to the other direction. They won't let anybody touch it. So it's interesting that they're looking at it here. And maybe since you followed the hearing yesterday, maybe you could ask me about it. It might be a good
I got a couple of principles. There's a couple of principles which they've been focusing on, which you don't have to have heard the case. The case is basically Mississippi law says no abortions after 15 weeks. And I got Lita on the line. I want to get her on in just a second. And of course, Jean, you're always welcome to join as well. Be curious if anything's on live chat. Is anybody? Nope, no one's known. We do have live chat if you want to weigh in with your more controversial things. You don't want to call the show, or you just because you don't have time. I have a question that that no one seems to be asking. Well, it's more of a statement, actually. They're always trying to find out when life begins. That's not really the issue for me so much as the fact that life begins, okay? Well, if life begins, you know, at whatever point life begins, life is protected by the Constitution under life, liberty, and, you know, property. And, you know, it's one of our basic things that the whole government is set up to protect life, to protect your individual rights, to protect your accumulation of property. Is there to do certain things. So when exactly, you know, that's like saying, well, we have to determine exactly when you start accumulating property. Well, come on, give me a break. I'm not trying to oversimplify this, but the fact is that life begins. And because life begins, life has a right to life, you know, because it begins. So they're asking the wrong question as far as I'm concerned. That's a big issue. I've got a bunch more. I want to get to Lita, though. My other ones I want to get to are Stare Decisis and Marbury versus Madison, which figure prominently in the leftist justification for this. And those are two things you know a lot about. So that's why I say you don't have to know the case itself to know what's going on. But what do you think of the question that it doesn't matter when life begins? That's not really relevant because life does begin and deserves protection because life begins. Jonathan?
Even in the original Roe versus Wade, although, you know, like I say, it's a badly written thing, they were trying to balance the woman's rights against the baby's rights. So they were trying to say, well, at what point, that's why Roe versus Wade decided that when the baby is viable, that the, you know, in other words, it can exist, it could be born and outside of the womb, that the state could protect the baby's life. The subsequent precedents, like I say, because treating it like a super right, have, you know, trampled on that. But Roe versus Wade originally said that in trying to strike this balance, a state cannot prohibit abortion while the baby is, you know, could not live independently of the mother. And could not, you know, and so they were trying to decide when is that point. And you may not, you know, that the way I say it is disturbing, but that's what that's what you're saying. The mother can terminate the baby if the baby is alive, but is still dependent upon the mother's body for life.
See, that's irrational, like, because all babies start off dependent on the mother's body for life. So, you know, that to say that all of a sudden when they're not dependent on the mother's body for life, that's the point when they're alive, that doesn't make sense either. That's an artificial classification. I know they're using that. This whole concept of viability was big in the oral arguments, too. And I post them on my Facebook page in our Action Radio Legal Group. Just go online. Just look up Supreme Court. You know, this NPR and some other sources have the actual, they're editorializing beforehand, but just listen to the actual arguments. It's really quite striking. Let me bring Lita in the conversation here. You've been hanging on for a few minutes here. Do you want to get in on this, Lita? What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Hey, good morning, everyone. I'm just now hopping on. I do apologize for being out. I've had so much work trying to get done here.
It's okay. You just call in when you want to. It's no problem. We're always glad to have you, though.
Thank you. I have to say, I hate to say this, but I used to be a liberal.
That's okay. I was raised in a socialist family. I was, you know, really liberal for a while until I started analyzing. But it's okay. A lot of us start that way.
Yeah, I used to be for abortion and think that way.
What changed your mind?
Until I had a friend. I went with her to the abortion clinic, and it seemed nice. I mean, you know, it didn't seem like a big deal. She went through the motions, and she was with some guy, and they didn't want the baby. And so they went ahead and had an abortion right away, since I guess she found out she was pregnant. So I went with her, and then, everything was fine. You know, she was okay, but then she got pregnant again. And
same guy.
He didn't want it, but she was kind of hesitant, and she kind of wanted it. But then he talked her out of it, and, you know, she agreed again. Well, she went to the same clinic, and I guess she had some problems or something afterwards. She wasn't, like, being able to, I don't know what happened, but she kept calling them, and she was saying she was having issues, and they just kept telling her, oh, just put a heating pad over it or whatever. I don't know what they said. Just stupid stuff. They wouldn't look further into it. And then she ended up having to go to her doctor, a gynecologist or whoever, and they looked further into it, and I guess she wasn't having regular periods or something was wrong, or she had scarring or something.
Wow.
But they had to do an internal procedure on her, and like to open up from the scarring or something. I don't know. But she was just blown off, you know, from the abortion clinics. They didn't even follow up of any post, like, possible injury or scarring or who knows. I mean, I don't know what all they do because, you know, they drug them. They give them a pill or something to take or something. And so after that, it just, like, I was like, oh, you know, why don't they follow up with them? If something happens, something bad could really happen, you know?
Well, because it's a business that sells baby parts. I mean, it's a
yeah,
horrible,
yeah,
it's a business of death. It's a death industry. You know, it's not a life industry like hospitals used to be before they got remdesivir and, you know, started killing COVID patients. With other things, you know, the health industry has become a death industry, and it's really sad what's happening. But abortion was like the first death industry of medicine. Well, vaccines too, thalidomide and some of the other, you know, drugs that they were giving people were killing people. And this has been going on for a long time too. But the whole philosophy, you know, this is why, and I want to get into this too. In fact, we got Kyle on the line from California. But one of the things I want to talk about with Jonathan too is the fact that we wrote a bill here at Action Radio with the help of some, you know, pretty amazing conservative women that helped me out on this issue. And what I did was, in fact, Jonathan, you've probably seen the bill, but it may have been a while, but it basically splits abortion into two separate events under law. The first event is that a woman has a right to terminate a pregnancy. The second event is that you have to save the life of the baby. And the second event, you know, predominates. So in other words, if you're going to terminate a pregnancy, you have to do it at a time and in a way that saves the life of the baby. Of course, that then, you know, that's an admission of giving up parental rights to the mother, and then the father has rights. And, you know, it answers the question of equal protection, because under the current law, there is no equal protection for the baby or for the father in terms of his life choices, the same choices that the mother's making, and the choices that, well, except for biological differences, and the choice of the baby to live. You know, so there's huge inequality here. But what we did with this bill, and I think it really opens up an entire new avenue of conversation that no one else has even thought of. And this is kind of what I'm proud of that we do here on this show, is we are able to bring these new concepts, you know, to discussion, is that if you separate abortion into two separate events under law, you break the connection that an abortion always means the death of a baby, which never made sense to me, especially as medical technology gets better and better and better, and we're able to preserve the life of premature babies at a younger and younger age. Why would you not apply that to abortion? Separate the event. You don't want a state so oppressive as that women can never terminate their pregnancy. That doesn't seem right. But on the other hand, if you're going to do that, you have to do it in a way that saves the life of the baby. And this, to me, makes the most sense, you know, given this entire situation. And it's a pro-life, pro-choice bill that would allow at least the different sides here that are so polarized to be able to at least start talking to each other and open up a new avenue of discussion in law. That's what I think.
Right.
Yeah. Jonathan, let's bring you into this, and then we'll get Kyle. Jonathan, what do you think?
Yeah, well, like I say, I don't know if the arbitrary time of 15 weeks or whatever it is is the answer, but, you know, if you accept the Roe versus Wade's, you know, thinking, then medical advances would have to change their presumptive trimester system. You know, they came up with it saying that that the courts, the states could outlaw abortion in the third trimester based on this idea of viability, could not regulate it in the first, and I forget how they do it in the second trimester. It's sort of a mixed bag, But obviously, medical advances have to affect that based on the analysis of what they did. I don't know if 15 weeks is too early, but
how would you know when 15 weeks were? Unless you trace, you know, that's another thing too. And how do you know if people are having, you know, a lot of sex, which ones was the one that caused conception? How would you know? That's not the point, because, you know, it's like asking when life is, you know, when does life begin? It doesn't matter. Life begins, and therefore life gets protected. The other question I have for you, Jonathan, is, well, first of all, on our bill, if you want to take the bill up at a separate time, we could do that. But the idea that the Supreme Court cannot make national policy, they are not a legislature. They completely exceeded their authority. And this whole idea of assumptions being stronger than truth, the idea that the Supreme Court can dictate national policy and people have to follow it is absurd. Nobody has ever had to follow Roe v. Wade because they don't have the authority to do what they said they did, which is part of the problem with the court, judicial tyranny. Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
No, well, I mean, that's true. And it was very, it was very criticized in the time and has been since then that the,
was still there
that it was, I mean, it's just like, wait,
yeah.
You can hear me, right? It's,
yeah,
it,
I can hear
it's,
you fine.
They should not have weighed in. They should have let the political process decide.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court did the same thing ahead of the Civil War. They they stepped into a huge political debate and probably helped bring about the Civil War with the Dred Scott decision and all the Plessy versus Ferguson later and things where they tried to decide, you know, huge national disputes when they really should have just stayed out of it.
Especially if they didn't have jurisdiction
because the
Constitution didn't authorize them to have jurisdiction. And that's another case, too. Yeah, go ahead. And then I'll get Kyle.
Mm-hmm. No, that's what I say. I agree with that. And to me, if you any fair reading of Roe versus Wade invites reconsideration as medical technology changes. I don't see how you can avoid that.
I would do it from a legal aspect.
Really wanted.
Yeah, from a legal aspect, they need reconsideration the day it was written, but from a medical aspect especially. Let's get Kyle from California, then we'll go back to Lita on the actual medical aspects of this.
Okay.
Kyle, all the way from the Marxist motherland of California.
Yeah, it's just a quick little update. A lot of frustration over here. The cities, anything blue, Democratic, is freaking out again, wearing masks. I know this is a little off topic, but just to bring you up to date.
Yeah, that's
and
all. We'll get back on topic in a minute, yeah.
Yeah, 15 more seconds. And then if you go up into the mountains or anywhere where independents and Republicans hang out, unless you're 90, they're not wearing a mask. So it's so politically obvious, the separation of this country, it's ridiculous and sad, and I'd like to get back to my life. This topic is intense. I would say that, wow, whatever it is, you know, we have to, in marketing, a couple little points I would bring up. Mm-hmm. If you ask 10 people, you find the answer to anything. And, Greg, you're smart enough and wise enough, and you ask them indirectly and so forth to sometimes feel like you have the answer, and a lot of times you do. But I just remind everybody out there that, typically speaking, if you ask 10 wise, diverse people, any answer can be found. So I just think that this topic, you know, reminds you that would need a little time to develop to make sure you have everybody in mind, because it's pretty amazing if you're going to keep a child alive that, you know, it's so young and the expense to that and everything else. And in conclusion, it reminds me of a friend of mine's son that was life was saved by $3 million worth of work. You know, and believe me, you, every life is amazing. Every life is wonderful. But, you know, everybody's getting a new hip. Everybody's getting a new this. Everybody's getting all this money spent. And we're $160 trillion in debt. So with whatever you're doing with this bill, please keep that in mind of, wow, what does all this stuff cost if, and you know, you pull it off and do it? But it's amazing, and wow.
Well, how much does an abortion cost? You know, I mean, pregnancy is free once you're pregnant. You know, obviously there's health considerations and nutrition and, you know, doctor visits and things like that. But I don't, you know, if you want to put this in terms of dollars, you know, I've made the argument before that, you know, why do we rescue drug addicts who are dying in the street? You know, they're only going to go back to drugs. Why are you doing that? Well, because their life has value. That's why you do it. the same reason that you don't have abortions, that if you're going to have, if you're going to, you know, allow for a determination of a pregnancy, you don't allow for the killing of the baby. That's not, that's a, that can't be connected. That can't be an essential part of the termination of a pregnancy. That's what my bill is all about. Okay. So there are ways to do this, you know, and it's just, you know, if you're looking at it from a bean counter perspective, I reject that argument because that, because life has value. And
I didn't argue. I just asked you to consider it. And again, because it all does come back to beans in the end, and you have a very logical mind. And that's what the conservatives have a problem with, the lefty Democrats. The Democrats are emotional thinking. They're feeling thinking people. They don't really think about the
money.
Well,
not feeling and thinking on this issue. Because if they're feeling and thinking, they wouldn't make such a callous decision as abortion until they dismiss the preborn baby. Lita,
and that's the exact hypocrisy of the left. They, in the end, they really don't care. They act like they care, but they don't. And most parties don't care. Most people don't care in the end, so to speak. I don't mean to say that people aren't wonderful. People are wonderful. People are amazing. But in the end, it's all about them. But anyway, I was just talking about if you're saving, for instance, a seven-week-old child. Again, not saying that's right or wrong. That's a decision that has to be made by the 10 people or the masses or the if you're going to make a law about it.
Nah, I don't believe in a democracy on this one. I just
don't. You don't, and I'm just speaking my mind. And again, so what I'm just asking you to consider
quickly, we've got 9 minutes left.
What,
I want to get our other folks in.
I'm almost done. You're always whatever. As long as you know, come on. Anyway, so my point is that if you're saving a child that's that young and you're going to spend $3 million doing it, maybe it's more proactive in what you needed, maybe more counseling, maybe more don't have the child, maybe don't get to this point, whatever,
maybe
you know.
Birth control.
Yeah, because, again, you're right. Everything is worth saving, the drug addict, all the above. Again, that's the emotional side to me. That's the caring side to me. But the logical side to me says, too, is not everybody can have a new hip. Not everybody can have a new knee. Not everybody can have a new brain.
Yeah, I think you're
next?
Hold on, Kyle. You're getting off on a wild tangent here on a bunch of different topics that I really don't want to – I got a couple things I need to cover in the time that we have remaining on this issue to get this in the podcast. But, yeah, I mean, I appreciate your call. But there's just – there's too many things to do. One of them is this whole idea of, well, let me get to Lita and then Gene and then Jonathan. Then I got a couple quick things to bring up. Well, which we may have to extend next time. Gene, you haven't been on this for a bit. You got a comment here?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I just think it's so interesting that if someone kills a pregnant woman, that person could get charged with killing the unborn baby. But yet, it's okay for them to kill an unborn baby. Because that's what they're doing.
Jonathan, how's that square with the law? Jonathan, you're somewhere. Yeah, welcome back.
I mean, I think that many of those laws were passed to illustrate the problem. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely, I mean, it definitely, you know, shows the inconsistency here and the logic. I think that's, yeah, I think that they've been sharpened on that, and like I say, they have to consider both lives, and so.
Well, and this is the thing too. This whole, you know, I made the argument in my bill that there's no such thing as pro-choice. There's only pro-choice times three, and that no one person should have the right to decide, you know, for three people. So you've got the woman who decides for herself, which makes sense. I mean, everybody has the right to decide for themselves. And this is why I say that, you know, the ability to terminate a pregnancy is not something that should be automatically dismissed. However, the woman cannot decide for the life of the baby. The baby has a right to life because the baby exists. Life has begun. When exactly? I don't know. We can argue that for a while, too. But the fact is, life does begin. And once it's begun, you know, it needs protecting. And then you've got, you know, the 14th Amendment, I was going to bring this in too, the Equal Protection Clause. Where's the choice of the father to either be a father if he wants to and if the mother wants an abortion? And where's the choice of the father to not be a father if he doesn't want the same right as the woman to have to abort a child or not, you know, not become a parent? So you've got an entire group of – you've got three people involved with this, and yet only the Supreme Court's awarding all the decision powers to one, not only over themselves, but over the other two. And that's where that's wrong. And that's a direct violation of the 14th Amendment. And that didn't even come up in the arguments. I don't think anybody's made that argument. Let me go to Jonathan again, and then we'll go around our group here.
Well,
Jonathan?
Nothing to add to that. That's exactly right. So we're only in a few moments, so I'll pass.
Okay. Lita?
Yeah, I think
I think they're just trying to avoid truth as far as that the baby is alive. It is a living being.
Mm-hmm.
And wrapping it up with reasons and justifications and things like that. But really and truly, it is alive. It's a human being. And
mm-hmm.
I've got friends that is the prodigal of a rape. And they're, you know, they give their testimony that, you know, I'm glad my mom didn't have an abortion because I'm a child of rape. And he's a high functional person and
mm-hmm.
active in the community. And he gives his testimony. And they're there. They're out there, you know, and they're not horrible people. So,
yeah, and there's no law that says you have to have an abortion because, you know, you're a victim of rape. That would be insane. And so,
right.
You know, and the laws that we have are not for, you know, and like my bill is not designed to have any effect on women that want to save their babies or that want to have, you know, maybe end a pregnancy for the purpose of saving a baby because there's something wrong with them that, you know, some health and things I don't even know about. I'm not a medical expert, but the point is the reason I wrote my law is specifically in those cases where women want to make the death of the baby a condition. An automatic connection to the abortion. And I'm saying, you know, as new law, we can separate those out. I'm going to get Kyle's opinion on that,
right.
On that specific issue. But I think that's well worth considering. And I'm going to save the stare decisis and the Marbury versus Madison for another time. Kyle, do you see the logic in separating the decision to end a pregnancy and save the life of the baby from an abortion that automatically connects the two?
There is no way I can give a logical or a feeling or a combination. I'm a middle child, and so I think from my heart as well as my wallet. And this is a deep subject. In conclusion, I would just say that I've always understood the emotional and feeling side of this, although they're not consistent with their acts, with their thoughts or their. What comes out of their mouth isn't consistent with what they do, and the logical side of it and the biblical side of it, but maybe that's not logical or consistent, I don't know. But anyway, it's an intense topic, no doubt.
Yeah, okay. Let me hold you right there. Let's get to Jean and see if you have further comments on this. We've got about 3 minutes left.
No, I don't have any further comments, but you said made perfect sense to me.
Okay. This is the reason I will never do, talk about abortion topic. I have to have women call us here because we don't get pregnant, but we guys are fathers, and that implies a whole other responsibility. So there's a whole school of thought that men's choice, you know, and the choice is, you know, what do we say? Well, let's do that. We've got about 3 minutes left. What about the choice of fathers that are losing children that they would, you know, Jesse brought this up yesterday, fathers that are losing children to abortion, they are suffering a loss. They would happily be the parent. And if we had a situation where women, you know, who want to terminate a pregnancy could terminate the pregnancy and the rights would automatically go to the father first and then maybe to, you know, adoptions or other things like that. But we're missing half the argument, and the court never even thought about this. I don't think any court's ever taken up the rights of a father in an abortion or in the decision. I'm going to go through. We got let's do our panel again. So let me start with Jonathan and then Lita, then Kyle.
I think,
okay, Jean, go ahead.
I totally
agree
with that.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Because you're still preserving the life of the baby and you're preserving the parental rights of people to choose to be parents or not. But I still see this as a pro-choice time three, that fathers have a stand in determining their life choices. If you grant women the right to make their life choices, then you have to be able to grant the right to men to make their life choices. And the only way that I could see to do that was to separate abortion from into two acts, terminating a pregnancy and saving the life of the baby. Lita, what do you think?
Well, it's a difficult thing because they made it difficult. And it's funny how the original person who was in this Roe versus Wade is now against the decision.
Yeah. Norman McCorvey. Yeah.
Yeah. So back in October 2020, Sean Foyt from Bethel, he came to Dallas. And we participated in the march against the abortion, October 3rd, I believe it was, when we went. And we walked across the bridge in Dallas, and we went to the courthouse
We went to the federal building, the Earl Cable Federal Building. We went there and prayed over it back in 2020 for this abortion to be, you know, to end, to respect the laws of life. And, you know, I believe in prayer, you know that. So, of course, things did turn around. I feel like it did, you know, because it did, actually.
Well, the country's changing.
And the state
and
of Texas,
I think,
so.
Yeah, we got less than a minute left. And I want to kind of close up. Thank you. No, I appreciate your comment. But the last thing is the fact that medical technology has changed so much. There's been such an incredible awareness in this country, you know, through ultrasound and through everything else that, you know, babies are babies. You know, they're not just clumps of cells, as the left was perpetuating this lie. And I think a lot of people were pro-choice because they thought, hey, it's a clump of cells. You know, you're not aborting a person. You're just, you know, you're just ending something that hasn't developed in anything yet. I think that made it much more acceptable, which is why the left used that argument. But the truth is, as we're finding out now, that babies develop far faster. You know, they're pretty much at 15 weeks, pretty fully formed. Well, actually, I can't go to Jonathan. We're out of time. But I think that's something that we really seriously need to think about, is that everything has changed since Roe v. Wade. It never had a basis in law, and it certainly doesn't have a basis in our human consciousness. I guess we're going to have to leave it. So thank you all. We're out of time, but this has been a fascinating discussion. We need to do more of this. We may pick it up next Thursday. I'll talk to Jonathan, and of course, you're all welcome to call back, and we'll do it at that time. Anyway, I'm actually going to end on time today. Wow, this is weird. Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction and our brand new website, hopefully today, at www.writeyourlaws.com. That's WriteYourLaws. And I know it's a series. We're not walking out on a really high, happy note here. But listen to the case. Listen to the audio of the Supreme Court. Decide for yourself. Check out the laws. Check out our bill at writeyourlaws.com. On abortion. I'll post it. It's on my Facebook page and on the legal page, and I'll put it on the Action Radio group page, the news page, and you can take a look for yourselves. And until then, we're back tomorrow, 6 o'clock, with our Friday
show.
Have a good day.
Thanks, Gene. 6 in the morning, Central, 7 Eastern, 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific, and Hawaii, the middle of the night sometime.